whole group here from the ANC, just about African National Congress. Welcome back, Honorable Bongani Mkhongi. I'm glad to see you looking better as well. Thank you. And we have the other two members, our whip, Honorable Kalako and Honorable Kroenhoff. Honorable Williams is ill. He's got a medical apology in for this morning. And then we have three other apologies, late apologies, not apologies for the meeting, but they're held up with getting here, either on flights or by road. And that is the two DA members, the Honourable Hill Lewis and the Honourable Dean McPherson. The whip of the IFP, the Honourable Naren Singh, has just confirmed that the IFP will be joining us in about 10-15 minutes' time. And that completes the, well, doesn't quite, the EFF are not here, but they are busy with rules and an ad hoc committee, the one member there. So that is not taking precedence, and we are trying to get someone else from the IFP as well to join us in place of the Honourable Floyd Chihambu. But having said that, I think that, oh yeah, I forgot the Honourable Mantash is on serious medical leave. She's been booked off until the end of September, so she's also not here. But on that particular note, I would like to welcome all the members of GTI and also, I think we've got here the medical fabrication centre coming with you. I mean, you're coming in first. I'll introduce the others as we approach the item on the agenda. But from the GTI, Ms. Pele, Ryan's Chief Director, Capital Equipment and Metals, Mr. Moody Munsey, Director, Non-Ferrous Metals. Thank you. And Mrs. Metsa Amani, Director, Rail Transport Equipment. Thank you. And so on. And then from the foundry itself, we've got Mr. Jardine, CSIR, and Project Leader, and then Mr. Mamele, also from CSIR Manager Strategic Implementation Initiative. Thank you very much for being here, and let us get the done the apologies. We need to adopt the agenda, but with one small addition, and perhaps we'll make that at tea time, and that is with respect to the program. And I would rather wait until all, as many members as possible, are present. I want to put on record my appreciation for the Honourable Kalaku, who served as chairperson here during my absence last week. Thank you very much, Honourable Kalaku, for chairing the meetings in my absence. Right, can we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda? Honourable Kalaku, seconded by the Honourable Kroenhoff. So just so that members who are making the presentations are clear, we're only expecting another three members who are delayed. But we've got a long program, and so we need to get started. This is a very important sector, and that is foundry technology. Very important. So we'd like to hand over to whoever's handing, giving the presentation. Is that yourself, Chief Director? Right. So we're going to hand over to your help, Ms. Pele, and your namesake, of course, I'm pretty sure, Pele, a footballer. I don't suppose you've got any sons playing football. Okay. We could do with some of them in the fauna, but go ahead.
Thanks, Chairperson. As a way of introduction, I'm Sandy Pele. I'm from the Industrial Development Division of the DTI. I'm responsible for metal fabrication, intrapersonal equipment, and grade issues. We call ourselves the sector desk. There's been a couple of protocol committee issues on a number of sectors that we are responsible for in the DTI. For today's presentation, I'm going to be covering a broad spectrum of the work that we do at the sector desk, innovations that we have worked together on with the industry. It's really encouraging to see the industry members that help us develop and implement policies that we are responsible for within the GDI. It's also encouraging to see the policy enhancement and faster that has been really instrumental in the work that we are doing around rail localization program. As a way of an overview, I will first touch on how do we classify the national fabrication sector so that we proceed on the same understanding and basis. I will touch on some of the key dynamics globally and what has been some of the major growth drivers within the sector. We'll look at an overview of how the sector has performed in the past 20 years. And what are some of the opportunities to further develop the sector and some of the key point constraints? We'll look at the pillars of our sector strategy within the DTI, and as I've indicated, some of the interventions we've made today. And we will conclude on some of further policy issues that we are looking at in order to unlock development in the sector. As a world classification, the first sector that I forgot to mention, that as a sector, I'm responsible for four work streams. The ferrous metals, which is inclusive of upstream steel industry and scrap metal. Downstream, which we classify as fabricated metal products, which would include components such as pipes, structural steel, extrusions, wire products, castings. Second stream of work is on the non-ferrous sector, which would include the work that we do on aluminium, copper, brass, all non-ferrous related industry. Capital equipment, we do include machinery and equipment, items such as valves, transformers, material handling, and so on and so forth, and the engineering and allied services. And that way, we look at rolling stock and the rail infrastructure. For us, this sector or this cluster of industry is very vital to any modern economy. Because practically they produce tools, casting, components, systems that are used across a number of sectors. So for us, this is at the heart of our industrialization part. Some of the key recent global dynamics will include, as we all know, we have been really recovered from the 2008 global downturn. Our economies are characterized by declining global output. Recently, this has been exacerbated by the decline in Chinese exports and consumption. We are at the end of the communist boom, the commodity boom. We have declining commodity prices, which is resulting in declining in mining activities. And for us, mining is important because it remains one of the key markets for our sectors. Obviously, we have an increase in Chinese exports of primary steel, midstream, aluminium, and finished ferrous goods. This is a problem in our domestic industry, also in our export industry. For the first time in China, in 2014, exported 100 billion of primary steel, thanks to the history of steel making. So this for us, is really alarming. Where are we finding markets for the goods that we make in South Africa? How are we maintaining our competitiveness? And how do we find a way to compete against other markets, i.e., such as the China growth and development strategy? We have high tariffs because of the issues around global downturn. Markets globally are still characterized by high tariffs to protect the interests of the domestic or national interests. We have issues of non-typical barriers in potential export markets. What have been some trends in our sector from a gross value addition, which we can simply put as output? As I've indicated, the downturn, we are growing nicely after 2008 until we're hit by the crisis. We are beginning to recover, but we are not at the levels that we're growing at the crisis. On the employment side, as we know, upstream is a bit is very capital intensive by nature of production. We are not likely to be able to see job creation coming out of the upstream industry. Downstream industry remains one of the key manufacturing of remains an element of our labor intensive industries within the broader manufacturing industry, employing close to 350,000 employees. But the point that we are making is that although upstream is not labor intensive, we need upstream in order to develop and further deepen our relationship in the downstream side. On some of the investments that we have made, you will see that the line of the trend on the upstream cost-fixed capital formation has really been flattening over time. On the downstream side, we were growing up to 2012-2013, where we are seeing a bit of a decline in investment to that industry. Trading performance, the first line, this one is looking at the trading performance mainly in the upstream side. We have always been a very export-oriented industry, particularly in primary steel and aluminium. The upstream includes aluminium, primary steel, and all non-ferrous items on the upstream side. We were growing up to the point when we were hit by the crisis. We have recovered. The trend is going up. But also, for the issues that I've already mentioned previously, we are also starting to see increasing imports on the primary side. Here we're looking at our exports of ferrous scrap. It has been on the rise, and as government is saying in the current energy constraint, in the current issues of trying to improve our environment, scrap remains one of the cleaner way of producing. It's a key element or a key raw material into our foundry industry. So we will try to find ways of we can help the effort of scrap in order to defend our regulation. 2013, that's the time when we introduced the new pricing preference model. We have seen a bit of a decline in our exports, but it is not at the significant rate as we'd like it to be. This continues on looking at, because of the scale, I've included the two graphs together. This one looks at our exports of non-ferrous scrap metals. In areas such as, for example, copper, where there's been a number of initiatives within government to decrease issues of theft, putting in place measures to deal with theft, to deal with issues about protecting infrastructure. There's been a decline in exports of theft, of copper, but from an industrial policy point of view, ferrous, scrap, and aluminium particularly, remains the two elements in our industrial policy side, because that's where we make components that go into the automotive, castings that go into the infrastructure. So we would like to see the growth of the foundry industry, which is backed by how we are utilizing our scrap collection in order to begin the region. Exports of downstream, the brown line on top represents our capabilities in rail. That line will include, I think, most of the growth in that line will include items such as Excel, where we have very competitive companies in South Africa making components into our rail infrastructure. Another growth that we have in the export is on capital equipment, because traditionally we have a very solid capabilities in mining equipment, which remains one of the items or products that we are exporting. On the import front, because of the big infrastructure programs that are driving as the economy, both private and public, particularly the public side, you are expected to see growth in imports of capital equipment and machinery, because that's in the nature of an industrial development part, you are likely going to be buying items such as machinery equipment. But the point that we are making is that we do have elements of global competitiveness. So therefore, we would like to see a decline in our import intensity as we are deepening our infrastructure. Hence, we have introduced a number of initiatives to really drive localization across the broad spectrum of our infrastructure. What are some of the key opportunities are the public infrastructure build program, both in local markets, in the African continent, remains the single largest opportunity to stimulate demand, to stimulate growth in this industry. Mining, for many things that it has, remains a key demand pulling for our metal fabrication industry. So we're looking at how can we leverage the mining activities taking place in Africa, taking place in South America, despite the decline in the commodity prices or the end of the commodity boom. You know, mining for us remains the most strategic industry in order to develop the growth and development of our metal industry. As an industry, we have a really visible maturity in terms of competitiveness, in terms of recognition. So we're saying that we still see opportunities in expanding value chains through further developing downstream manufacturing industry. As I've already indicated, our sectors contribute or make a number of products that go into other sectors. So if the automotive industry grows, we are likely going to see the growth, you know, putting into our industry, because that's where we account for issues such as castings, body parts, and so forth and so on. Another ADVP, because of how we have structured the program to be based on production volumes, we also want to deepen component manufacturing within our automotive space, so therefore it remains one of the opportunities. What are some of the key finding constraints? Energy, supply availability and rising energy costs, both on gas and electricity. If it is a growing problem in our metal, in our electric industries, e.g. such as in the steel mills, in the foundry side, because of the nature of the operation, we are going to melt, so therefore we need to find ways of mitigating against the rising energy costs. Availability and cost of key intermediates, as I've already indicated, the issues on scrap, the issues of steel, because of the issues, legacy issues that we have had on our steel industry, it remains a key challenge in terms of availability of right quality, right quantities, technical aspects in order to support the downstream industry. Rail and logistics area, if we want to be competitive in the export markets, we need to find a way of sorting out the rails and the logistics area, because of some of the issues of high transport costs in South Africa is already eroding our competitiveness generally. So the issues I've already mentioned in terms of the slump in the Chinese economy, we are seeing over capacity in the global markets, in the steel industry, coupled with global declining of our prices, which are really beginning to significantly threaten the viability of our local steel industry. I've already spoken about the downward pressure in the number of value added. In South Africa, because of our commitments into the WTO, for example, we are beginning to see a downward pressure into the tariff on our value added products, which is resulting in a surge of imports, as you've seen in one of the slides, particularly in areas where we have low value by high volume manufacturing activities. We have made progress in terms of the localization program, but we're still seeing lack of understanding and compliance to some of our localization program. With that said, what are the key pillars of the strategy from the DGI? First of all, the current administration has committed to a 75% local content across garment procurement. How are we responding to that commitment? For us, we're doing this through designation under the triple PMA and localization program. Because of the nature of manufacturing, for us, we have decided to put lots of efforts into the tooling and the casting industry, because they remain a significant block of manufacturing value add. So we can't talk about creation of value addition in the manufacturing industry if we do not have a viable tooling and foundry industry. So on that front, we have two programs that we are running: the National Foundry Technology Network and the National Tooling Initiative. And the colleagues that I have from industry will talk a bit on those two programs. We want to also formulate dedicated support for the sector to address issues such as
such as the cost and access to relevant industrial financing program. Because of the need of the industry, we continue to engage with industry to develop position papers so that the policies that we are implementing are backed by coherent research, factual scientific research that are responding to the industry needs. This is a dialogue with industry and but to look at where the opportunities, how can we mitigate the risks in what we are trying to achieve. What are some of the interventions that we have made to date? Under local innovation, we have designated, today we have designated three sectors, valves and actuators as a 20%, rolling stock, 65% on average, power clients. In the second wave of designation, we have already done the work on spiral conveyance pipes, transformers, revision of the power pylons to include power line hardware, monopoles, and so forth, which have been approved by the Minister and are currently under consideration by National Treasury. As already indicated, we have worked with the Department of Economic Development Department in 2013, where we have seen introduction of a new price preference system to deal with some of the issues that we are experiencing in the supermarket. Under the National Process Technology Network, we have an intervention program housed at the CSIR to assist the foundry industry to improve its competitiveness. Three, the program is structured as the three pillars to which, first of all, is the issues around how are we going to develop the skills. Through a partnership with NFT and then the South African Institute of Foundering, three chairs, new chairs have been developed and are currently under approval processes by the relevant authorities. By to date, we have also trained more than 500 guests in various modules of the CETA approved qualifications. We are doing a number of firm-level interventions where we are taking founders in the areas of flexible layout, simulation, product development. All these are designed at improving the competitiveness of the foundry industry, finding a way of reducing. Going forward, we're going to place more emphasis on the issues around facilitating energy audit assessment and dealing with the issues of compliance with environmental regulations. On the National Green Initiative, similarly with the fund program, we have focused a lot of effort around skills development issues. We formed a partnership with the industry, the tooling industry, where we have seen a number of achievements to date. We have secured funding through the National Skills Development Skills Fund to pilot a new qualification that we have developed together with the industry. Today, we have already a number of students that have already completed the courseway of this new qualification that are awaiting to undertake the new trade test. In 2013, the new apprenticeship qualification was approved by the South African SAPA, which subsequently in 2015, we have seen the new trade test being approved by authorities within the Department of Higher Education. This marks the importance of integrating this new qualification into the mission. Then going forward, we all want to be a toolmaker in the industry, can be trained under this new tooling qualification, working together with the FETs, working together with the Department of Higher Education. So we're saying that we have done what we needed to do as a department, or we entered the East around skills development not because it's in the mandate of the ETS. We do it in order to improve the competitiveness of the industry. The Minister in November 2014 launched the first tooling center of excellence at NEXA, and this center is being earmarked to run the first trade test to open under this qualification. Going forward, going back to the mandate of the ETI, we're going to place a lot of efforts on enterprise development, competitiveness improvement at the federal level. On the last financing front, under the 12 items incentives within the sector, the metal fabrication sector, today, we have supported 13 investors with a tax hold-on of 2 billion rand, which has leveraged 8 billion private investment and was in 2009. Under the Reflection and Competitiveness Enhancement Program, we have supported 249 firms to the tune of 1.5 billion. In the previous program, one of the programs that we ran at the EPI, at the Enterprise Investment Program, since inception, we have given grant support up to 785 million. To date, it has already been dispersed to industry, and we have supported 200 firms within the sector. 2014, the Minister launched a gold loan scheme, which is housed at the IDC to support some of our larger manufacturing. What are some of the key highlights in the sector? In 2013, Quasar signed the 51 billion contract with Develop Consortium to supply 3,600 coaches over 10 years. This contract embeds more than 65% local content we achieved over the contract lifespan. 2014, Transnet awarded 1,064 tenders with 4 OEMs to a collective value of 50 billion. All OEMs have to adhere to the requirements of the regulation. In the recent outward mission to France, we have seen Transnet Engineering going into a partnership with Vincent Engineering, where they're going to assist us, which has resulted in the procurement of automated copper winding machine, which will improve efficiency as Transnet Engineering could score in the areas of rotating business. As I've already indicated, all OEMs that have signed with PASA and Transnet, and I hope the colleagues from Transnet and PASA will touch on this point, they are already in engagement in some level of discussion with the local industry. Today, some of the key contracts that have been signed, I have mentioned that today, Transnet Engineering is going to play a major role in terms of assembly across all contracts, the ones that are assigned to Transnet. Companies such as Four Metals, Swagab, DCD, you know, there's a whole host of suppliers that are participating in the Lake Street Capitalization Program. Behind the procurement, from an industry point of view, we have seen significant investments in the areas of factory space, machinery and equipment, re-equipping the factory in order to be able to deliver on this commitment and to be able to meet the levels of localization program or localization targets. In another area of where we have designated for Bell, we have also seen a number of key very big orders flowing into our local industry. For example, RTL are supplying ball valves to Transnet Pipeline, Dunwich is supplying butterfly valves to Umgeni and Renault. So there's a whole lot of activity that is taking place, and we are seeing way at the beginning the issues of compliance, and I guess because with any new introduction of a policy, you know, it requires engagement, it requires, you know, participation of both the local industry and the procurement entity to understand where are we trying to drive to. So we are seeing even procurement entities that in the past were not complying with the localization imperative, over time, through the engagements, through, you know, efforts that we've made on ourselves and the local industry to drive through the issues of designation and localization, there's been a change in the market where compliance is starting to really improve. In the main space also, as a back of some of the contracts that Sunlight is working on with General Electric, they've committed to investing 700 million in the areas to support innovation, enterprise, and skills development in the country. One of our key flagship companies in the country, in Greenbelt, we have given it a support under MSEP, for example, which in 2014 they've produced a South African locomotive which boosts 80% local content. And these locomotives are currently being exported to a number of African countries. As a part of the partnership that we also work on with the IDC, we have seen, we have managed to retain our one and only company in the country that makes electric resistant welding pipe, which saves the capacity in the country and also ensures that we do not lose the 200 directors that are in that company. In way of conclusion,
And what are some of the issues that we're still working on? It has already indicated that through localization and designation, there's still elements of non-compliance in various tiers of government and state-owned enterprises. So we think there's still, although we have made strides, we still think that there's still significant room to improve local content supply, the various processes within the procurement programs. For the issue that I've already explained on scrap metal, with the interventions that we have made in the past or in the recent past, they have not really led to a significant reduction in exports of scrap metal. So there's an urgent need for an alternative and stringent interventions. We are working on alternatives with our state department, the economic development and national treasury. The global condition calls for some form of support to our primary steel industry, but I think this has to come, the support has to come against conditionalities that will ensure the viability of both the up and the downstream industry. Escalating energy costs, we're saying yes, we understand that there's issues of energy efficiency that the industry has to implement, but the issue of rise escalating energy costs, and we need to make take of what do those mean in terms of the viability of more or less energy intensive industries such as the metal fabrication industry, especially for the steel making and the foundry operations. Port charges and rail and port inefficiencies, we are making investments, Hardman is making a number of investments to improve capacity, to improve efficiencies. But we still think that there has to be an element of rebalancing and also improvements in that area. Industrial financing, as I've already indicated, we have given a number of support. Well, I forgot to also mention that the IEC also has given a number of support towards the metal fabrication industry. But we believe that there's still further room for some form of economic support package to ensure that we unlock our private sector investment and catalyze industrialization.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Director Ms. Pelle. We are going to engage with DTI first before we get on to the other three presentations and do an engagement on them together or separately. We'll see how time goes. Just as a matter of request to all of you, when you are using abbreviations in the book and in your presentation, please note, for example, NAMB is not the National Mortgage Board, but the National Artisan Moderation Body. Now, you would know that. I doubt anyone sitting here who's trying to exercise oversight, NAMB. QC2TO, we would know it's something to do with quality, but would we know it's the Quality Council for Trade Occupations? We wouldn't know. In future, have a page giving all the abbreviations that you are using in all of your presentations. That way, should you overlook it, it will already have been covered there. And I certainly will hand over to members to follow through, but I am concerned that the scrap metal export issue is not effectively yet addressed, as you indicate. Right. We're going to turn to members of the committee on our list, the Honourable Bongani, Mkongi, and let's get right.
No, thank you very much, Professor. I have a number of questions. There are many, many, many questions. I'm not sure whether we have time to deal with all them. Let me just say, I would like to welcome the representation from the Department of Energy, especially the presentation of this metal dust is very, very, very important. And we have raised a number of steel ores that the industry is using into other industries. So it's very strategic for the economy of South Africa. But we can't discuss the importance of this industry outside of the strategic agenda of the state. That the agenda of government in North Africa is to make sure that we have inclusive growth. If you talk about an inclusive growth in the Republic of South Africa, the dynamic is the question of the standing of the majority of the population, which happens to be Africans in particular and black people in general. Now, when we talk about this industry, I would like to know what is the transformation barometer of the industry. Give me. Who controls the industry? Who? I want statistics. How many black people are there? How many women are there? What is their age? Which provinces dominate this industry? Etc. That is fundamental. It's fundamental because we don't talk about inclusive growth if we don't go into these issues. Who are these people that are driving this economy? It takes me to the transformation of the logistics sector. Because who is there? Go to the airport, you go to the towns, you go everywhere, who is there? So the question of transformation is fundamental for me when we discuss this matter. Secondly, you have a relationship that you have put between the upstream and the downstream. Who is there in the downstream? Industries are not supported or that gain from it. When we do stationary, where is it going and who is there? So the question of the transformation agenda is at the heart of us succeeding to achieve an objective of an inclusive economy. If you go for me into education, said, I was reading now what you are presenting, the shortages of artisans and engineers in South Africa. Did I just release that report? No. I read through that report in terms of the engineers and also in terms of the artisans. We have a serious crisis. But what are we doing with the higher education? I just read the Minister of Higher Education now is also still raising this matter. Because we said by 2030, we need to be having so much engineers, I think it's 8,000. How many do we have now? Because the program was developed in 2010. So how many do we have? Are they supporting this program? So I have two questions simply. One is the transformation agenda of the industry. The second one is the question of the skilling of our young people to enter into the sector. But if we're not skilling them, it's still going to stay as it is today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mkongi. I have a couple, some of them related to your new training programs, the ones which you've just developed, the new qualification test or trade test. You indicate on page 19 that you have trained 272 students. They've completed the coursework, but they're waiting to be trade tested. How long have they been waiting, and how much longer will they have to wait before they are tested under this new qualification? The other issue is with respect to the rail recapitalization program on page 22, and there the signing of the $51 billion contract with the Gabela Consortium. Are there any challenges, or is that going ahead smoothly? Just see it on page 21 here. Let me just see. Right. Or 22. The other one is with respect to the locomotive tender awarded by Transnet, and maybe that one we can wait for Transnet. How's that proceeding? make references to some of the binding constraints here for rail and high logistics, and also reference to energy. Well, we've got the rail people here, and perhaps they may be able to expand on your response, but what are you referring to with respect to the high logistic costs and, again, the energy constraints? You refer to yourself, and we're aware that the foundry uses a significant amount of energy in various sources. There's also a reference to something the committee has raised every year. More recently, it was when he visited Kuga, with respect to the scrap, steel, scrap iron, all of the scrap. We were requesting legislation, more rigorous regulation, and that was implemented even to the extent that the Minister of EDD was offering a discount, indicating to those who needed it from the country that it would be sold at a discounted price before anyone would be allowed to export it. And yet it seems to continue with impunity by those who intend flouting the law in this country. Related to that is the energy relationship. We know that if you use the scrap, it uses less energy. Therefore, why are we tackling this the manner in which? What is the problem? Is it enforcement or what? Exactly what is the problem with the scrap? Steel, what is it? I'd like you to tell the committee if you do know. And if you don't, say you've got no idea what the problem is. But it remains a serious impediment here. The other one is with respect to the localization. You indicate that it's either not understood or there's just a refusal to implement it. And that is on page 15, I think. A lack of understanding and compliance to the localization problem. Who is at fault here largely? Where is the problem? I would like to know, so the committee. If it's a lack of understanding, what is the DPI doing about it? Are you telling me that they don't understand localization and the requirements, regulating the requirements that they are obliged to meet? Or what? Or is it once again a refusal to comply and doing this with impunity by various people in this area of industrialization? Thank you. Over to yourself, Mr. Pele, Chief Director. Honourable Mkongi.
So, Chairperson, I limited my questions because I thought we have other members that they... Can I ask my questions?
You may have another 2 minutes. We allocated 9 minutes to questions.
Okay. No, I want to base myself on the question of the decline in the Chinese growth and consumption. Do we have efforts to encourage domestic demand? Why do we always depend on the demand, external demand? You know, what are the efforts that we're doing in terms of encouraging the domestic demand other than relying on the external demand? I know that is very important, but efforts for domestic demand. You know why I'm asking that? I'm asking in relation to your relationship of employment and country between the upstream and the downstream. And your graph agrees that in terms of downstream, that is where you actually found more employment opportunities. So I don't agree. What's your position? That is the first question. Thank you, Chairperson. It's among the questions you raised. Do we have to think about checking the export of scrap metal? Or we said that there must not be export of scrap metal. Do we check or we have? Do we care the export of scrap metals, or we care the export of it's very fundamental in terms of policy direction, and we can't understand what we are talking about. Another one is the question of charging of the exportation of scrap metals. We can also ask in terms of analysis that is taking place. What would be the relationship? You can explain to me that charging in relation to the pace of the stealing of copper, aluminium, exorbitant, and they have the function of the crab yak in our own country. You have a slide on 12. You have a graph there of exports on downstream, and you spoke about our Argentina, which is this was the town one, which is increasing. Now, our interest is, what is the reason for the declining? Capital national, declining electrical national in the downstream and union. What could be the fundamental factors that influences the decline of the 12? Let's slide 12. You have a graph there of the expo downstream. And if you look at other graphs, they are below the one that we have activity. So what are the factors that influence that decline? I think those are the ones that I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Mkongi. Over to you, Chief Director, Ms. Pele.
Thanks, Chief Leslie. That would be justice to the business. I think that, can I follow with combine the questions? Let's talk about the issue of our demands. This sector is very demand driven. Without demand, we can never grow the industry. We can produce. If we do not have market, it does as good as not have non-produced. And in that context, I raised the question about the Chinese growth. To say, traditionally, we were able to support our domestic needs and be able to find export markets. With the decline in the Chinese growth, with all the capacity they have created in the past, they have to find alternative markets. So therefore, the pie is smaller, and the pie is even smaller because we are competing for the same market. So in the past, the steel industry in China was producing for its own internal needs. Now with the decline in the Chinese growth, the Chinese consumption means the same capacity in China. If they have to keep it running at the capacity that they are running at, they have to find alternative markets. So we find ourselves squeezed that one in the domestic economy with the decline in mining activity, demand has shrunk. With the demand changing, it means we have to compete with the imports from other markets. In the export markets, we are also buying those markets elsewhere. So it was in that context that the issue of the Chinese issue was raised. What are we doing on the issues about rising aggregate demand? Besides, that's precisely the reason why we emphasize the issue about the localization program and designation. And within the law, as a state, we can only control what we pass as a state. With the private sector, we can only improve our process, because within our WTO, we can't, force the private sector to actually buy from the local industries, but we can influence and have a conversation with them. So we're saying within the issues about localization and designation, as a state, we want to ensure that we maximize the opportunities that are within our own procurement. And we're doing this precisely to stimulate demand. We raise the issue about African growth and development. And we think as a country we need to be aggressive in terms of how we approach the continent. Are we going to approach the continent in a peaceful way, or are we going to say as a country, given the opportunities that are there, if we take in the capacity to do railway manufacturing in the country, at some point, Pakistan Transnet, they're not going to be buying the same fleet as they're buying today. So the capacity that we are facing locally, over the horizon, we need to find alternative markets for it. And we say it's in that package of a conversation. How are we utilizing the infrastructure to build the capacity, the capability locally, and how are we influencing the Africa Growth Development Agenda in order to ensure that it becomes a demand pulling for our industry. So for us, the issue of finding alternative markets, creating demands for the local industry, is very pertinent to our conversation. How are we doing this? And we are already in conversations, for example, with the mines to see in the areas that we have designated, so what is going to utilize the same job that we are buying as a country, as a state? How do we get into a conversation? Because for us, the issue of our supply is developing the localization. We don't want
people to do it because it's a rule. We want people to do it because it's strategic to have a supplier, not to go to where you are producing yourself. You know, so we are in that conversation to say how in aggregate are we going to develop this subsector, this cluster of industry in order for it to be competitive and in order for it to be able to produce goods and services that we need as an economy. Linked to that is the issue about what is, remember when I was giving the presentation, I said for us, the farming industry is very strategic. Now, castings, you find it everywhere, in the rail program, in the automotive program, everywhere, there's a casting of some kind. So we're saying the issues of scrap to us, remember, every department, we have a mandate. Our mandate is industrial development. Issues of theft, issues of vandalization of the infrastructure is important, but the instruments do not lie within the GTI. Pull off interventions that we can make. Whatever you talked about how are the players behaving, what are the rules that are, you know, they have to adhere to. Remember, a couple of years ago they introduced the Second Hand Goods Act. We're supposed to govern how we are trading in the second market. And the issues about how, what is the registration process, how do we go about issuing the export permit, and of course the issue about the cash preference system that was introduced to our sister requirement in 2018 is not that the rules are not sufficient. Players in the market have found ways to circumvent the process. You go and speak to the founders, you go to speak to the minimum, they'll tell you the scrap yards now they're saying come and collect your scrap at 12 o'clock midnight. You know, you find a heap of scrap sitting there. How would you know at 12 o'clock midnight is this ferrous, is it non-ferrous, is it aluminium? You know, the issue is not that the law is not sufficient. It's how we have found ways to circumvent the process. Yeah. And everybody says, do we cap the exportation or do we make scrap available in sufficient quantity to the local market? I mean, currently our scrap collection is greater than our demand. So how the cash preference system was fished in such a way to say, give the local industry the best hand, provide for the local needs and the excess you can export. Because there's no point of us saying, don't export everything, but at this current point, we are not able to consume everything that we are collecting. But given the way that the food industry is organized, I think we need to get to a point of deciding, you know, do we do this in order to protect the integrity of our infrastructure and be able to support our industrialization process. And therefore, the choices that we are talking about, do we care or do we just make sufficient? You know, and I think it has to be at the core of the conversation. What would be optimal for the development path that we are trying to follow as a country? And that's the conversation that we are having with our sister government, with the International Trade and Administration Commission, and also we also have the conversation within the broader police spectrum to see how are we dealing with the issue of theft. Because that's the DTI. It's a criminal act which the DTI can't substitute. But it's at the core of the work that we do, because without the threat then we can't produce either. So it's a vicious cycle. How are we engaged in that collective conversation? The issues about energy, perhaps we're saying that the cost reflective philosophy, we can get there, but it's the pace at which we are getting there. We have mega flex rates from ESCOM, we have municipal rates. On top of the mega flex, the founders are paying a municipal rate, which is throwing them to be way outside the competitiveness gap. Hence, we're talking about what are the trade-offs, you know, in terms of rising our tariffs in the electricity phase, and how are we making the industry to be viable over the medium to long term. So, trying to be talking about introducing energy efficiency programs to ensure that we are able to produce as efficiently as possible. But escalation in cost remains the key issue in the conversation. Similarly, with the issues of rail, ports, already but in the national, in the NPA, we're talking about creating a rebate to influence regulation. When they say if you are, and that's the conversation that we are having with the national port authority to look at, they've already announced, I think it's a billion rebate that they want to create, to say if you are at a certain level of the benching, how is the rebate going to be utilized to ensure that we give sufficient support to companies that are very creative in the country. As you know, in the past, there was a direct way of doing things. If you're in a commodity business, you get a lower cost charge than if you were exporting a car. So we're saying, how do we flip that around to say, let's charge considerably for our value-adding sectors, and our commodities have to be tied also a cost-reflective term. So that's the conversation that we're having. And I on the issue about Transnet and the rail recapitalization with FADA, can I request, Chair, that we pass the question for after the colleagues of Transnet and FADA have made their own presentation, and we can see if we can add from what they're going to give to the committee. Issues of transformation. As you know, our manufacturing industry, transformation is there, but it is happening at a bit of a slow pace. But how do we make a transformation? I guess it's also part of the conversation in the room. To say, we've introduced codes of good practice to look at all elements that are going to help us to make a transformation. In terms of ownership, yes, we're still lagging behind, but in terms of other elements within the code, we are really making progress in there. Additionally to that, the minister, the deputy minister, has introduced a program called the Back Industrialist Drive. It was created in a manner that's going to fast track transformation in our manufacturing industry. It's not a standalone program, it still remains within the basket of how we must transform to drive transformation in our manufacturing industry broadly. You know, for the issues that we have raised our industry. The industry will very much be residing in our three metropoles, which is Gauteng, KZN, elements in the Eastern Cape, because our automotive industry is in the Eastern Cape. As I've indicated, it's a very demand-driven. So you locate where the demand is. So you find, you know, pockets of industrial capacity being created at the level of where I'm heading to. So it's still within the normal structures, but how are we specially, you know, decentralize the economic activity to take it to the areas that were not there? You know, they were there in the past, but over time have really diminished. Hence, within this year, we're also talking about revitalizing the previous industrial areas, you know, the seaport, the Babeleni, where there was previously an industrial activities, but over time has diminished. How can you revitalize those towns to ensure that we still go, we bring back economic activities in those areas? So the issues about transformation are very pertinent to our conversation, but we think growth and transformation are mutually reinforcing. If we do not grow the industry, we will not have the opportunity to transform, because we can't buy into businesses that are dying. How do we revitalize manufacturing activity, and how do we bring in transformation that is going to be sustainable over time? You know, within the rail recapitalization program, we've already seen pockets of creation of back industrialists. We have created companies that ordinarily wouldn't have been there if it wasn't at the back of the demand. So for us, we want to deal with the issues about and creating the capacity.
Thank you very much, Chief Director, Ms. Pele. And now, members, we're moving to the presentation. Well, can we do that at the end of all of this? Because we are dealing with this further on, and we just want to catch up on that time. I'm just getting the schedule register with names on, and which has disappeared again. Right. We've got, this is the National Foundry Technology Network. Mr. Jardine, project leader, will you be giving us the presentation, or your colleague, Mr. Lee Malele? Who's giving us
the presentation?
It's Mr. Jardine.
Correct.
Right. Now, if you would go ahead with that presentation, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, as was brought out in the last presentation, the cost levels of the foundry industry is a very, very important one for us in the country. And it's a very, very high labor-intensive environment, and I think also a very vital one. So very briefly, an introduction, the NTN, or the National Foundry Technology Network. We are mandated by the DTI to enhance competitiveness and transformation in the craft industry subsegment, and we have focused inventions to do that, and they're all designed at the enabling industry. We've been around since 2008. We are funded by the DTI, and as was mentioned in the previous presentation, we are hosted at the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. We have a structure which ensures our governance, and that includes an executive committee and a steering committee. Our vision really is to increase the local competitiveness of the local foundry base through the provision of appropriate services, most of these being engineering services, to reduce importage, increase local production, and increase investment into the sector. Our mission, basically to provide program management, coordination, and facilitation to support and enable revitalization of foundries. And as has been alluded to, a large part of that goes into skills training, and then we do additional technology transfer, and then diffusion of state-of-the-art technologies into each and every one of those foundries. What our desired outcome for the industry looks like, essentially, is a transformed and competent costly manufacturing industry subsegment in South Africa. And that would include growth in core manufacturing, vital to industrialization, and include manufacturing at the volume economies of scale required to compete with the Chinese, the Indians, the Russians, and others out there. The manufacture of cost-competitive products, the increase in our capacity to design and innovate through engineering solutions, high volumes of locally cost products being sold not only in our local market but also internationally, a culture of continuous improvement in the industry, development of skills, job retention and job creation, new entrepreneurial enterprises, and exploitation of export opportunities. This slide is really to give you a bit of an understanding of the process and the emphasis on the scrap metals, which we then convert and we produce wonderful products. And I think the example of the milling wheel that you might see there on your right hand side, very good example. Most of us have one of those in our car. And an engine box just below that. And very few of those are produced in the country at the moment, except for heavy duty trucks, which are made down in Cape Town. The engines are made down in Cape Town. So, just to put in context, a bit of an industry profile from our perspective. We are dealing with a key manufacturing industry. We know there is a need for revitalization. We know the industry is in decline. There have been 15 foundries that have closed their doors since 2010. There's been 1,080 jobs lost since then. Of that, 850 were last year. There's a lack of volume to achieve manufacturing economies of scale. Our local volume, even if we did achieve many of the products that are being localized, we need to actually cross borders into new sectors or into international markets in order to achieve those economies of scale. Our infrastructure in the not only in the surroundings of the industry but also in the industry are aging, and we need capital investments into equipment and plants and so forth. There is a low utilization in many of the foundries. So although infrastructure is there, although the capacity is there, the demand isn't, and the utilities are idle. And you'd be shocked to know that the old foundries are running at 30% capacity. Local buyers are, in many instances, also struggling. ultimate finding that they're coming with ones and twos, and to go into an economy where we want to actually produce higher volumes of the same thing, it's converse to where we actually want to find ourselves. And then the limited collaboration in the industry to develop effective capacity and capability is certainly something that we can't deal with at the moment. So we deal with 170 companies, just over 10,000 people employed. The sectors cover most of the key sectors you would imagine, and the previous presenter also mentioned the importance of automotive, of capital equipment, infrastructure, construction, mining. There you'll see in this particular slide the importance of mining is probably the biggest influence in the country, railway, agriculture, other. What's interesting is that 74% of the companies have been in existence for over 20 years. There are a substantial number of those which are actually in existence since 40 years. Many of these companies are actually privately owned, small businesses, employing less than 50 people. So that is a primary input as a material, and essentially the industry is a secondary economy. What we find is a lot of segmentation. So it's not as though every foundry can produce every product that you like. There are very, very specific foundries with very specific products. So when one tries to actually look at trying to improve the cost-quality ratio and try to achieve the economies of scale, you've got an economic sector that the foundry might be focused into the process they use or the material that they are processing. So in some instances, the material might be ferrous or non-ferrous. The process might be a sand-related process versus a fish mold type of process. Or people may be focused into mining, which is very different towards motive and very little chance that you can actually cross over between the two necessarily. There is capacity to manufacture in the designated sectors. And the company capitalization ranges from small to export ready. Now, I'm putting these slides just to help the discussion and understanding when we're talking small to export ready, what that actually means. And the idea behind this slide, which I borrowed from one of my colleagues in the DTI, essentially goes through an assessment process. And the buyer would come in and essentially look at what kind of capacity they can buy from. And you, from small to capable, or capable to accredited, or from accredited to export focused, is a very, very difficult process which needs to be facilitated. And I think it's important to listen to this. That is part of the task that the NFGN tries to perform in helping move companies along the chain. So a small company typically, although it has obviously a few people in the employ, it has no investment, it needs a lot of money in order to fuel it to take it to the point where it's export focused. And very often the structures and processes that people are running are insufficient, where you're probably reliant on a single person who is not only the technical manager, but the financial manager, the managing director, and HR director, and so forth. So take them into a capable environment and accredited, which is where you'd like to see most of the companies growing so that they are more presentable, perhaps, to an international market. Doesn't mean that the small companies can't succeed where they are. There's a very real need for them. And these are the companies that probably succeed up near the mining facility. And they're not really too worried about the export focus required. Although some of those will also obviously move in that direction. In the need survey that we conducted in 2011, we identified human capital development as being the single biggest issue. Access to market, or perhaps we can call it off-take commitments, the cost availability and quality of scrap metals, energy management, not surprisingly, all three of those have been addressed. And then we had an issue where people identified that competitiveness was going to be a challenge. Environmental and waste management was predicted as something that was really a worry. Technology and innovation, and then capital for investment were all raised as major issues. We have recently done a similar survey, and we found that if one looks at the graph on the right, the human capital development at 98% is still a major issue. If we look at imports and access to markets together, similar size, similar scale issues, and then of course scrap metals, energy management. So not surprisingly, we see a lot of overlap there still. When one talks about off-take commitments, from a quite disconcerting when one sees the high volume of import products, which we could help localize each country. We know that the perceived cost gap we find in the industry is something that can be engineered. The fact that overseas products are 30% or 50% more expensive, the local products are 50% or 30% more expensive than imported products is not surprising. If we had engineered products over the last 30 years in the rail industry, we probably would be competitive. What happens is that engineering changes are brought about on a regular basis, where these industries are transformed from being what we might recognize similar to our own industry 23 years ago, and they have used innovation and new technologies, and we need to catch up and close that gap. So the localization of castings requires a lot of engineering support. There's also a lot of transparency required in order to understand what's happening in the supply chain. And one of the challenges that certainly we perceive is that in talking to the buyers, whether it be the competitor that was mentioned earlier, or whether it be with a belt manufacturer, is that certainly the transparency stops somewhere around about their confidentiality agreement with all the different companies, so there are some issues with the rest. The limits of opportunities has fading down to the boundaries as a result. There are certainly, fortunately, some, which the previous presenter actually alluded to. And then, of course, we are also dealing with poor business confidence at the moment. And then, I think probably the most worrying is the disproportional activity in our country versus what we see in other countries. The slide I've put in here, I think, emphasizes the fact that if you look at the automotive sector and importance in Brazil, India, China, and the other hot BRICS grouping, automotive plays a very, very important part. And if we had to add in Germany, North America, it would be a very similar graph where automotive was much more important perhaps than any of the other sectors. In South Africa, you see that the mining sector is more important, automotive less so. And I think that's a very, very important discourse at this point in time, in that the importance of automotive in our sector is being influenced. Out of the 850 people jobs that we lost last year, 400 of us were in an automotive industry. So in terms of what are we doing, we are constantly trying to find out where are the foundries in the development cycle and to help them build through so they can get to the next phase or next stage. We've done 65 foundry assessments where we've used an international best practice benchmark, and we've then interviewed the foundries and helped them to understand what they need to do in order to close that gap. We've done an industry survey between the BRICS countries in iron products. We've done an industry survey with India, where we looked at understanding their variances versus ours. We've looked at collaborative partnerships created with key stakeholders. We have one running with the German Ministry of Education and Research at the moment. We're looking at a number of different technologies in sand, in scrap reduction, and also in energy usage. And then we also are helping in order to access international specialists and then membership with the World Foundry Organization, and of course very important in the British Union, where we are trying to get some form of collaboration with other countries. So future activities into this space, essentially there's additional benchmarks that need to be done in terms of steel and non-ferrous segments, and collaborative partnerships, essentially to unlock potential. And it's always going to be a case-by-case basis, that segmentation we talked about earlier, and perhaps even case studies from overseas or the Asian markets indicate that case-by-case, step-by-step, brick-by-brick. And then, of course, very important is the industry forums, where there will be a lot of focus on addressing technical needs. So human capital is one of the key interventions. It is definitely a competitiveness challenge. In order to grow skills, we realize that we lag far behind the other BRICS countries, and we need to ensure that there's optimum training for key skills. So the programs that we've been involved with include the artisan program mentioned earlier, which is for melters, molders, and pattern makers. Then we looked at foundry skills, which is essentially for foundry workers. And then we looked at professional skills, where we're looking at technicians, engineers, and trying to uplift their skill to broaden their perspective and their knowledge, and we'll speak a bit more about that in a second. There are also regional training center focuses, so we have one in Gauteng, and we are looking at the feasibility of one in KZN. Yes, I'll ask each of them to after this one. So the graph here in front of you, this was on the iron foundries. Essentially, what is interesting here is if you look in senior management, we are looking at pretty much 100% in Brazil and in India of their management with tertiary education. In South Africa, we are 25%. That's a stark variance, which is reinforced perhaps when one looks at the middle management graph in the middle, and that shows you where 50% of the people hired into middle management in Brazil have tertiary degrees, and that's versus 4% higher in the country. In India, 90% of the people have technical, tertiary technical certificates. This is our own 29% here. So the emphasis, very clearly, is that we've got a lot of work to do in order to uplift. However, it is fair to say is that we do have some excellent programs and we do have some excellent targets. And the gap, to me, rather lies in the fact that as we try to expand capacity in many families, I mentioned maybe 30%, to take that to 60%, we need double the amount of people. For a foundry, a big foundry, like Scorpio, for instance, as they expand, maybe the training needs are slightly different, but also they will send additional people. From an artisan skills point of view, there just aren't enough qualified artisans for current needs. And there are not enough training capacity in the different regions. So we have a learnership program which was started in 2010. There were 18 learners enrolled into that program. They finished their 14 of them finished their qualifications, and they're going to be presented for their trade test this year. That program has been by agreement and design replaced by the artisan program, where we focused on those three core trades, not some molded pattern maker. There's a really good training center established in Quartena at Killian East College. And certainly I would encourage anybody in the region to let us know. We'd be very pleased to take you there. And we're in the process of doing a feasibility for a training center in KZN, where we believe the demographics and dynamic growth of that region will be different to Quartena. And as a result, we expect to probably see a slightly different model. Some interesting components, maybe focus more towards incorporation or some other form of outcome. Of course, there are additional opportunities to open up other facilities where feasible. In the GFTC, as we call it, which is the Gauteng Foundry Training Center, it's not surprising that it's successful in the sense that we have 66% of the foundries in the country concentrated in close proximity. They, however, cannot train for everybody in the country, and certainly we do need to make sure that we do spread the footprint. One of the challenges is that we are not yet part of the higher education funding structure. So the partnership involved with the program at this point in time is ourselves, the NFTM, the Gauteng Department of Economic Development, and the Agri-Learning East College, supported by the SAIF, who have been very instrumental in this program. So that's a South African student partner. So the operation launched in 2013, and we enrolled the first students in 2014. We are accredited to do the mold and pattern maker test, trade test. There's a staff of three. Currently, we have 33 people in the program, 11 in the first year and 12 in the second year, and all students are registered with Machita. The program that we run in partnership with SAIF, essentially focusing on foundry skills, has been an extremely successful one. It's looking at what do we need to do basically on the shop floor, and going back to the graph that I presented earlier, in terms of the amount of on-the-job training that's needed in our foundries because of the lack of perhaps tertiary engagement. It's incredibly important that this program actually offers the workers an understanding of what they're doing and what is required along them in order to have a successful foundry. So although it's an entry of 2 to 4, it's an intensive program and consists of certificate training towards a diploma and some customized courses basically where there's a special need. So there's been 25 diplomas presented, and it's for anybody who has successfully completed at least six of the eight different specific training modules. There are over 500 workers who have attended these training programs, and it certainly is working very well at the moment. We've got just over 100 who have actually been registered already in this financial year. So on-site training is done across the country, and there are a number of boundaries through different provinces, 17 over the period. And then there are also advanced technical training programs that are taking place. So we need to make sure as a future activity that we get everything accredited. So all programs, there's a standard, and that's certainly something we're working towards. And there's a need to understand exactly what it is that the industry needs and just confirm that we're on the right track. The professional skills is really an interesting one. One of the questions raised earlier is what is being done about transformation. This is one of our transformation programs. It's probably flagship for us in terms of transformation. Essentially, we're looking at young leaders and future managers and cross-tracking them so that they can gain experience and prepare them for promotion and perhaps even higher ownership. And where we lag behind other countries, we certainly are able to close the gap if we promote young people. And so attrition, I'm glad to say, is that the majority of these people are in the right demographic. So the New Market Generation Forum program itself is for young professionals under the age of 45. It has stretched a little bit perhaps in the definition of age, but Madam Chair, I think it was important because we needed to make sure that these people were closing the gap in terms of young people coming into the industry and their just investment to our aging. It's a platform for networking and learning, and I think the emphasis on social capital is reinforced and has been hugely successful in this area. And secondly, it's through exposure and learning into what you haven't necessarily learnt in your traditional academia environments. So current program, as an example, we have a year one program that includes a module where we analyze root cause analysis, which has been very, very widely accepted. And it's, in fact, the AIGC modified their program and we've been one of the partners in this, where we see some very big successes. Then we have some other modules where we expose the students to front-end technologies, and this is simulation and design. We have 3D printing machines, and it's really important that they can actually see how you can actually close the gaps by using all the new technology in order to reduce the time, reduce cost, and so forth. And then we, as a network, we make sure that we do interactive feedback sessions with industry and engage in much tighter forum like this, where there's questions and answers, where there are opportunities for sharing of experiences and so forth. So we had 14 participants on PT year one in 2014, and we currently have 15 participants enrolled this year. On the right, there's just a graph which basically shows that the majority of the people enrolled are from top 10, but we also do have participation from both Mpumalanga and Western Cape. And once again, I think it's exciting to see Mpumalanga from Middleburg. You know, it's probably a rural environment. And our future activities is to get the two program involved, and we are currently working on a curriculum that will focus on management and leadership. So we'll move on from the technical, maybe into strategy and management, moving on to financial and so forth and so on. In terms of the competitiveness of foundries, they find it very difficult to compete. So what do we do about that? The competitors are low. They are, many of our buyers, and talks about the trends, but I can discuss later. They are one, the tenders are one on low competition. That means everything that they buy needs to be competitive low in order to actually keep a sustainable cost structure for those bidders. Our traditional markets are changing. The competition is in our backyard. It's not far away from us. We no longer, there is no protection from Africa or from Asia or from South America or North America or Europe. There are negative market trends, especially in the mining sector, where that's a direct impact on the foundry because with lost volume in that sector, so less people to buy. So far we've provided assistance to support 31 foundries, and these factors include accreditation and compliance, product development, products and process innovation. And then our focus, of course, this annual we're looking at 20 new foundries that will be enrolled to our program, and then continued assistance to at least 20 other foundries that we already have in our program. So here's some detail. In terms of the competitiveness, we need to find the people accredited. It's no good to try and compete with companies that are not necessarily recognized in terms of certification. In some instances it works and it's not a problem, but in many instances if you want to get into the capital equipment or into the rolling stock or automotive and so forth, you need to have the right type of accreditation. And against that target, there are only 39% of our foundries that are accredited. So we're talking about ISO 9001, that's CS169 for line for automotive, we're talking about PED for some of the high pressure valves and so forth, or even ISO, which is the new oil requirement, which is European recognized, but certainly people are looking at that in South Africa. So we work with the foundries where there's a need. We do have a partnership with CEDA, and we are certainly helping to close that gap in that direction. Where we can, we need to look at differentiation of our products and be strategic about what needs to be done. Now, the limited access to engineering skills certainly does constrain industry in a large degree in this area. And we don't have many design engineers developing new products. Now, that's not necessarily just in the farming industry. That is in all the associated industries where our buyers might be wanting to buy local. If we don't have design engineers, they just buy the insulation and we all do so. So, part of the intervention is to engineer a solution to improve the metal's look. We have an ESTACON collaboration project where we are looking at simulation characteristics for high chromite ions, which are very important in our mining industry. We have a program where we improve product quality, where we look at the performance or the efficiency of the products. We mentioned we do root cause analysis through the New Foundry Generation Forum, but certainly that's something to be done in each intervention. We're looking at the interaction of front-end engineering tools, maybe to grow a mold or before we actually put it into production. Product innovation, product differentiation, and then, of course, the provision of resources. In our industry, I think it's incredibly important that where the foundry doesn't necessarily have the resources, that we bring it through either one of the science councils or through academia or through the technology stations and so forth. There certainly are facilities to help. In terms of the innovation cycle and the innovation, this is a competition on price. And unless we can actually start changing the game, we fight in the Chinese at what they invest. And that's not really a long-term solution unless we do adaptive markets. So we've got job foundries with a diverse and complex range of products. And typically, we don't cut all the processes. We have a few of the processes. And to fight into that environment, we've looked at engineering solutions to improve process flows and the availability of materials. This is throughout the process that we make sure that we're not sitting with excesses, but we're not also sitting with starvation inside the foundry operation so that we end up with inefficiencies. We're looking at alternate processes into the foundry operation, so in some instances we might support the interaction of machining or maybe heat treatment. Looking at optimization of the product mix, so instead of being a jack of all trades, maybe it's good to actually focus on one or two products. The introduction of new processes, i.e. degassing, which is a support for the aluminium foundries, where this is causing lots of defects. Improvements in terms of sand reclamation processes and sand management practices, this really in conjunction with the ESTACON program. Provision of departmental of developmental resources. Once again, very important if one thinks about supplier development and enterprise development, that there's a support so that we know these foundries can actually move up between the different phases. This is perhaps an interesting slide. Just gives you an idea in terms of competitiveness relative between BRICS countries. And what this shows you, if you look at the material essentially, South Africa being the lowest, 28. 28% low is actually not a good thing, it's actually a bad thing. We have a lot of costs in our overhead, our equipment, and our labor and energy. This is the Chinese where they have 72% material cost on light products and a very, very much smaller component of their cost structure focused around overhead, equipment, labor, energy, and so forth. In fact, just on the slides, quite clear is that we've got a lot of challenges in every fight. What's also interesting is that the days that we work as manufacturers differ. So as a result, of South Africa, there's 242 workdays, where in India, there's 302. It's a huge difference. Quite despite the fact that we might not be running at full capacity, we still work 6 days less than the limit. Right on electricity. We all know this is a challenge at this stage. In terms of, there's been a number of different challenges or discussions around addressing the energy costs. That hasn't been successful at this stage. So we are looking at really how do we manage our energy better. We assess the foundries and we try to identify opportunities, and special attention basically turn off the lights when you're not using them. And then of course there's a big need to look at alternative energy as gas, wind, sun, and so forth, and those are being sourced as energy sources. In terms of environmental, this is a big challenge for us, and we're doing an analysis of what the different types of sand are that are being used in the industry, what kinds of effluent, I suppose, through the foundry waste dams recreated, what kind of air quality is found in the foundry and around it, and of course, once we've done those assessments, to that with GDOT or the especially in this instance, the Gauteng Department of Agriculture and local municipalities, to understand exactly what they need, and so that we can close the foundries with environmental issues while we try to build them, and then intervening to implement corrective actions on a part-by-part basis. We've talked a lot about scrap already this morning, so I won't stay on this one very much, but certainly is a big issue, and the dollar value of South African scrap is obviously highly favourable for importers at this point in time. And from a technology point of view, what's quite interesting here is that through our focus on international relationships and through some own expertise, we have the ability to actually look at some turnaround by doing technology and innovation and development. So we've got an EFSACON program which we were running, which I mentioned earlier, but we have a focus of technology localization with the science councils and the universities, and certainly there's some strategic national partnerships which can help us in that space. Reliance on an OEM to bring in that new technology, I think, is limited, and in my own understanding, looking at this through that EMEA and the Science Council, I think is going to be a big heads up for us. And then, of course, more use of front-end engineering and hosting and linking with overseas networks, I think, is very, very important. And we will be hosting the 2017 World Foundry Organization Technical Forum right here in Gauteng in 2017. I think there's a future for cooperatives and centers of innovation for skilled entrepreneurs that will need to be developed, and much more work to be done to work with the university to localize the technology. In terms of WFO, it's time for March 2017. It will have participation by both local and international specialists. It's a platform for presentation of local technical papers, and simply is a wonderful opportunity to showcase what we can do. And we'll collaborate as future opportunities with industry and academia, and certainly for a combination of local conflicts and exhibition, so we can really deliver it together. Access to capital, bottom line, I think, is continuous engagement with stakeholders, looking at good access to project related funds. We typically have a 4 to 6 week lead time on new products, and long-term pipelines of applications certainly are not as flexible as needed to move. So future activities of NFTN, certainly unlocking potential in core manufacturing. I think this is a big role of the SOCs, and certainly we'd like to be there to help. Support interventions for private foundries ongoing, and certainly something of importance need to continue. Enabling and empowering growth and development on the foundry by foundry approach, and then simply coordination and management and collaboration and so forth, being very, very important in the industry going forward, and ourselves and the network around us, I think, very, very important. To end, two case studies, and to the question asked earlier, are we able to, do we have black ownership in foundries? And I think we certainly can say yes, we do. And both these examples used here are from black-owned foundries. In this particular instance, we did an intervention, essentially product developed from a solid, you'll see in the middle picture, it is a solid, to a hollow bar to resolve with?
It's Mr. Jardine, is it? When you say yes and they are black owned or whatever, not in a preferred if you didn't make generalizations, exactly what's the name of the company that you're referring to?
This company is this is a Natal based company. The company's name is Microfish. It's a black owned company, that's 51%. This particular intervention caused a 37% cost reduction in their material costs. It's resulted in them being able to discount their piece price by 20% and increase their order intake dramatically. The second foundry is a company called Duva, which is Duva, D-U-V-H-A. It is Gauteng based. It is also a black-owned company, plus 51%. This is an entrepreneurial company. We've helped them to move from what is a very small facility, probably not much bigger than this room, into a real production facility, get their process flows right, and to resource themselves to develop kind of the product they need going forward, and also to get recognition into the value chain for transplants and so forth and so on. As a result of those interventions, they've successfully been approved by Transplant Engineering. They've got a 10 million rand contract, and they're currently being considered for 72 million rand contract of services every year. So it's a wonderful story of entrepreneurial spirit and job addition. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for that little bit of good news. As I indicated at the beginning, we won't take questions now. We'll take them at the end of the next presentation. So we'd like the next presentation by the South African Institute of Foundry Men, SAIF, and the Aluminium Federation of South Africa, AFSA, and that is Mr. Davies, Mr. Chris, and then you've got the Astra, well, that was Astra, and then the two of them right there, Davies from SAIF and Mr. Chris from AFSA. You're making a joint presentation. After your presentation, we'll take tea and then there'll be questions. Right. So, if we can move on in that manner, we would like to conclude that presentation at, it's now 10:02, and we'd like to conclude it at 20 past. All right, thank you. 20 past. So over to yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. quite a lot of the presentation has already been covered by previous speakers, so I'll be as brief as I can. This covers the scope of the presentation, and really the remit was to give some impression on the value of the National Foundry Technology Network interventions in the metal casting industry in South Africa. And so these are the topics that we'll be covering. The background of the Institute Foundry Men briefly, it was formed in 1939, and 1964 was de-linked from the Institute of British Foundry Men. It has a number of goals which really can be summarized in the focus on the dissemination of technical information to its members and the industry at large through the provision of training, seminars, symposia, and regular technical meetings. There are a number of colleagues with whom we participate. These are some of the key partnerships that we respect. You'll see that it's quite wide-ranging, and particularly with the tertiary educational institutions. Just a quick slide to show how the interaction works. This is actually an NTN slide of some years ago that really depicts, I think, all the role players in terms of improving the competitiveness of the local metal casting industry. The foundry industry is, a lot of these have already been stated, but there's been a serious contraction of the industry since 2007, and the output is down by 23% in tons. 170 quads now exist, and that's 36% fewer than in 2007. The industry is quite fragmented. We have large companies. We've got a few, only, of more than 1,000 employees, and we have a large number, more than 70, of companies with less than 20 people. There are some which are so-called in-house companies that produce for their own requirements exclusively, and the range of metals cost is wide, so from ferrous to non-ferrous, as we've mentioned today. The added value in machining, cutting and other finishing, and also assembly, is also evident in some factories. They are spread throughout South Africa, and more than 80% of all manufactured products contain castings. If you look at the geographical location of foundries, you'll see that, as has been mentioned, 66% of foundries are situated in Gauteng, and the others are spread around. The other centers of concentration are in the KZN, Western Cape, and Eastern Cape areas. There are other metal casting activities. I just noted at the bottom that we also have 13 arch foundries and 11 spin casting foundries that essentially make little buckles and medals and small artifacts.
The art foundries
are essentially producing statues in metal. So bronze statues would be art foundries. Spin casters are something different. They're the ones making metals. By foundry type, and, we essentially divide the foundry industry into two forms. One where the mold is not reusable, and the other where the mold is reusable. So a permanent mold is one which is used for repetitive production. But we have, in metal types, ferrous, we have 89 foundries. In non-ferrous, the next two columns, we've got 15, 27, 77 foundries, giving us a total of 170 core investment foundries. Investment casting foundries are those which use a commercial method of lost wax casting. In other words, the pot is made in the wax first, and then a shell built up around the wax, which is then removed under the influence of heat, and metal then cast into the shell. It's a very accurate form of casting production. And we have four of those in South Africa. This is probably the most significant graph, I think, that's affected the industry in recent years. Substantial reduction in output, virtually across all metals, and it's something particularly worrying to the industry. The markets served by the metal casting industry, automotive is significant, mining as well. Construction and general engineering, which includes motor stock, the energy markets, agriculture, and others. If one looks at the major sectors, the automotive and mining sectors, both of those are effectively, for the metal casting industry, have been distressed. And my colleague, Ms. Creed, will talk more about the automotive sector and the impact of castings in that sector. The casting processes I mentioned in sand and permanent mold, just giving you the percentage of foundries that are represented in those sectors. In Gauteng, where we have a concentration of foundries, you see that we have both what is called production foundries, where there's repetitive production, medium volume, jobbing foundries, which are minimum order quantity of one, and then there are a number that would sort of represent themselves as being a little bit of both. Employment in the sector has been mentioned. We have about 4,000 indirect employees that add value to products as well, which are either connected or closely associated with metal customers. The skills base, is quite important, just to show the breakup of three critical skills that have been mentioned, pelters, molders, and pattern makers. These are unique skills in the metal casting industry, and they should be seen as separate from the, let's call them the generic artisanal skills of boiler makers, electricians, fitters, millwrights, and so on, welders. The challenges facing the industry, I think this has been fairly enunciated already, import linkages over the last 20 years have created havoc in our industry. It's been a slow strangulation process. Reduction of orders results in low competitiveness because the economies of scale are not evident. Energy costs, we've spoken about. The poor material conversion efficiency that the previous speaker mentioned, although we have relatively competitive input material costs, we have a very high conversion cost associated with that. So low conversion efficiencies. The lack of skill development, the compliance cost of environmental regulations, the metal scrap issue comes again, and the limited access to capital. And recent technological developments require special skills. And I think this is not only in the car industry, but in all manufacturing industry. The use of laser technologies and computational technologies require certain advanced skills. The foundry environment is not a very attractive environment. It's often considered dark, dirty, and dangerous. We've, I think, covered a number of the issues with respect to the interventions from the National Foundry Technology Network on industry, the learnership pilot program that the Institute of Foundrymen, which I hosted in a sense of looking after the learners whilst they were going through the program, and that was successfully completed in 2013, the 14 of the initial 18 learners reaching their level of qualification of NQF level 4. And they, with the exception of one, had been placed in industry, and the last one had a job, and we're now seeking another position for him, the contract that he had come to completion. Apprentice training is, I think, something that we need to just emphasize, the need for apprentice training outside of the industry. There are companies that are, individual companies that are employing and contracting youth as apprentices in the trades for foundries, but there are simply too few of them. So the outcomes are far too thin, and it was necessary to have another training facility in the form of this high-tech foundry training center to supplement the training that's done in industry. And we believe that this is going to close the gap rather more quickly than with just the industry working on it. These statistics have already been quoted. Let me just say that there's the need for the portion of training that would take place on the job. The industry and the industry representatives, I think, will play a special role in making sure that the training is provided and that the training is properly structured as well. We have already heard that I think it's necessary to find a way of ensuring the sustainability of this training through the Department of Higher Education. And just these are some pictures of some of the activities in the training center in terms of both the recruitment overlay and activities in the training center. The short course training program that has been delivered by the South African Institute of Foundrymen has been around for some time. We've been delivering in the Western Cape initially in the 90s, and the NFTN have been particularly supportive in enabling us to roll out these programs to a much wider market. And yeah, more than 500, in fact, 663 learners have attended courses. And I think it's we're presenting programs in a number of different venues around the country, using subject matter experts from industry in many cases. Some of the comments that have come from industry, I think you can just take a moment to read that. At the bottom, the comment from Kimberley Engineering was, where we are currently also in fact providing further training programs, has been a direct effect on our operations. So I think definitely empowering workers with technical knowledge has made a significant impact on the level of knowledge in the industry in total. The New Founding Generation Forum, we believe it's a very, very important intervention and program that certainly is going to add a lot of value to raising the knowledge and expertise and capacity of young leaders that have been identified in the industry. Technical support programs, the initial program provided actually by the Department of Science and Technology, if I'm allowed to say it, the so-called TESS program, that had a very positive response. We were involved in doing the assessment survey of that, and certainly it was a very positive response from those boundaries that were in that program. There's various benchmarking programs that have been undertaken, all of which have some value in terms of analysing exactly where the gaps are between the industry and the international players. Some of the competitiveness improvement programs involved in the Vault Hungary Initiative, a number of training courses were rolled out, as well as specific intervention with the South African Roll Company, which had a very difficult surface defect problem. KwaZulu-Natal, Bell Equipment as well has been assisted with the reduction in scrap related to the input of their cost of supply. Micromicron has been referred to. It's an important advantage for local foundries because they're supplying a lot of this material into the mining industry. The microcost, which is the example that's already been used. I'll use another example of Fistro, which is also an empower company, which is Peter Maritzburg, where they had serious improvements. The overseas experts that have been assisted to come to South Africa, one has been a Dr. Moss Murray, and he certainly made a big impact over the years, improving energy efficiency, and especially in the die-casting industry. The NFTN have also, in fact, received a number of publications, all of which have found value in the industry, and a lot have become standard handbooks. The EFSIBAN program, which has been mentioned, also an important intervention involving assistance from Jim. The new localization faster opportunities, some of these has been mentioned, but there's certainly, I think, it's one of the key opportunities for the industry that we also recognize. The mentorship of developing foundries. Several rural foundries were assisted in the early parts of this decade, and we know at least one black-owned foundry business that was assisted in startup. The key issues going forward really remain the issues around metal scrap, energy, localization, capital investment, technology transfer, human capital development to keep the momentum going. And then really a question, what happens after 2017? Will the foundries continue to receive support as this may be, I think, the termination of the current program with regards to the National Foundry Technology Network? I can ask that question. And the World Foundry Organization is just to say that we're totally in support of this and we believe that this could be a big event for the metal casting industry in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I believe then that's up Mr. Davies, not Davies, right? We need then to move immediately with Mr. Crick, is that correct?
That's right.
Right, let's quickly move into that. And just while we're waiting for that shift over, I was going to give you this information at tea time. But on Friday, the 14th of August, you will get officially from Mr. Madima. We did have a double presentation starting at 8:30 to 12:30, investment, and then there was something else as well. We've taken off the second issue. We have retained the presentation by DTI Investment, and we need to shift that to 8 o'clock so that we finish at 9:15. That is Friday. We can't take off investment, we can't find the further space for it, and it is becoming increasingly more critical, especially as we do have the promotion and protection of investment bill on the table now. So if you'd get that straight, 8 o'clock on Friday until 9:15, we hope to finish then and not at 9:30. That's Friday the 14th in E249. Thank you. Over to yourself, Mr. Craig.
Good morning, Alicia. Thank you, and to the audience for the opportunity to present to you. I'm the Aluminium Federation of South Africa, who founded in 1983. We do not involve ourselves in commercial issues. We give technical support to the members of the Aluminium Federation. I want to talk about the aluminium industry globally and in South Africa, just touch on that, in specifically give some feedback on NFK interventions. That would be at a very high level, and then down the into a presentation, into an investigation that we did into the automotive sector together with the NFGA. I want to talk about the importance of aluminium in the transport sector, and then just give an update on a conference that was held in Durban 2 weeks ago called Localization in Zaba. And then conclude with some remarks. I've already touched on the Aluminium Federation, ASA. We promote the use of aluminium and we promote the aluminium industry in South Africa. And our members range from the smelters, the second smelters, the semi-fabricators, fabricators, founders, distributors, and suppliers. Yeah. This is the life cycle of aluminium. We produce primary metal in the country, in Richards Bay. That enters the value chain as semi-fabricated products are produced. In many countries around the country, these would be sheet plate and foil, extrusions, castings, and the like. These are processed into components which are put into the end products, such as buildings, a lot used in the architectural sector, the automotive sector, the aircraft sector, at the end of life, and also into the process. Scrap is generated, which is collected and recycled in the secondary smelting industry, re-enters the value chain. This is the industry in South Africa. We do import some raw materials. The primary metal manufacturer, the Fieldline smelter, is aluminium and cast house. Secondary smelters process the scrap. And as you said, into the industry, and I'm going to focus really only on the casting sector, which is my next slide, which shows that we have metal coming in from the primary sector and also metal coming from the secondary smelters.
Mr. Beck, we just want to interrupt for a minute to indicate to the learners watching this and obviously observing and trying to absorb something here. This is about the Industrial Policy Action Plan. I hope you've heard about it. And given that it is the Industrial Policy Action Plan, we are dealing with the metals fabrication. And we've dealt with a number of issues here. We certainly hope none of you are involved in finishing the scrap metal from cables and selling it. And we're now dealing with aluminium and the important role that plays in contributing to the industrialization of South Africa and the production of metal components. And Mr. Chris is here for us. Thank you, Mr. Chris.
Thank you. On the left-hand side, we've seen the primary aluminium production, which is alloyed and enters the foundry sector, but only in a very small number of foundries. That is replaced for the raw material for the manufacture of aluminium wheels. The other components used in many other sectors of the industry are based on secondary aluminium, based on scrap. So we have sand casters, gravity die casters, and high pressure die casters, all based their raw material on secondary aluminium, and the low pressure die casters producing mainly wheels, which produces primary metal. And that is actually for reasons of purity of the metal for the finished product. The production of in the country is split from 2008 from 35,000 tons to 22,000 tons per annum. That's a 37% decrease. And I've split that up into the real production, which has been a 32% increase, and the component manufacturing housing that reduced by 50%. Getting along in figures.
The last point, that this is Madingo High School. You're very welcome to South Africa. I see you from Swaziland, one of our neighbors, that we have a complementary industrialization program with. You're very welcome. Thank you. And this is trade and industry. Thank you.
The previous highlight I showed graphically, it just shows that 77% of the production of castings in the country are for wheels, 17,000 tons. And if we look at the mass components sector, the 5,000 tons, 60% of that is for the automotive sector, and then there's some products for mining, consumer durable, electrical, and architectural. But the importance of the key message is that 91% of the products are for the automotive sector. We've also, in the sector, David Rodriguez and the other presenters, had significant reductions and also reductions in jobs. So total to date would be some almost 5,000 jobs lost. We've also closed the two secondary schools that have closed. Regarding the National Foundry Technology Network, the Aluminium Federation was closely engaged in conceptualizing the NFTN. And now I would like to give just some short feedback, almost anecdotal, on some of the benchmarks and initiatives that have carried out in the foundry sector by the NFTN. The very first one, from my memory, was the energy audit. One of our foundries reported a cost reduction of 21%, which was an excellent achievement. And one of the bigger ones is the excellent presentation of actual savings of energy intensity from 900 kilowatt hours per ton to 675, which is a 25% reduction in ton in the energy. John Davis spoke about the visit by Morris Murray on diagnostic specialists. I would really say that some of his recommendations lead to some boundaries that actually prevented them from closing. It actually turned them right around. The design was critiqued, reduced energy, specific energy, quality improvement, reduced scrap, improved competitiveness. The banking initiative, I've talking one about one specific one which was carried out on the shop floor, was a 5-day event, largely funded by each company. But the feedback was that it boosted knowledge and morale on the shop floor, and management gained new insights, and I found that interesting aspect too. Metal solidification, that's using computers to model the solidification of the metal. One of the numbers reported today that it simply would not implement the die without doing the simulation because it results in quality, less porosity, less scrap, and less competitiveness. Okay, then probably the most significant initiative that the Aluminium Federation engaged in was a study of the automotive supply chain and whether there was a need for it for a competitiveness improvement initiative in the sector. It was a high-level assessment that covered about 25 of the founders, and it was done in 2012 and 2013. I'm going to start with smaller, job-inside foundries who actually reported an increase in automotive component orders. These are typically very small, generic type items. But many of them are new to the automotive industry, and I thought we had to give them some support and mentoring in that regard. It's quite a specialized industry with very specialized requirements and demands. But in conclusion, we found that those industries had benefited from the NFTN type of CIIs, so continuous improvement initiatives, and would continue to do so. When we came to the Tier 1 production side founders, and the Tier 1 is a company that's supplied directly to the car company manufacturing plant, we found that the products made in the country include certain aged engine locks, hand covers, and wheels, along with all the smaller parts. But to produce these parts, which are really critical parts, either safety critical or quality critical, companies have to be qualified to the OEM standards. As already been mentioned, TS16949, etc. These companies are qualified and are successfully supplying those industries as companies. And I list them Audi, BMW, Ford, GM, Mercedes, Benz, Toyota, Volkswagen, I think all household names. Procurement by these companies is today done as it's global strategic sourcing, they call it. The purchasing decisions are very often 7 years before the launch, 8 more months before the launch. Third decisions, purchasing decisions would be taken by the OEM with key suppliers about 5 years before the launch. All I'm saying is it's critical to get into the game at a very early stage, and that for a company that's far out of it, South America, it is an additional challenge. So in conclusion of the survey, we found that we have qualified foundry supplying the automotive supply chain. Significant investments have been made in state-of-the-art equipment, and I think this is in contrast to the generalization that foundries are old and have old equipment and are not investing. The foundries have benefited from NFC and interventions. However, the volumes that we produce in the country are too low to be competitive, and the volumes are shrinking. Currently, or at the time of the study, no new model range had been made. So we really said that that Tier 1 automotive sector was, the foundry sector was at risk. So it was one of the key funds. I've introduced a few pictures, I hope, for your interest. This is a core, we have very sophisticated core milling facility. This is part made in sand, it's sort of into the mold. The metal is cast into, when it solidifies, you see the little gap at the end of that picture. Those are the cooling channels that are left when using great sand after the casting. We have a very high pressure, state-of-the-art high pressure die casting machine that's been purchased. It's a significant investment. And starting on the left, on the right bottom, that's another picture of the high pressure die casting machine. The middle right hand and middle picture show the measuring equipment, absolutely state-of-the-art, to world-class standards, and the product that's produced. We also interviewed some of the customers. Generally, they are in support of the HVDP. If you find it later, apologize for that. And also the Vision 2020, which is contained in the APGB. Generally, they were surprised by the extent and diversity of the local foundry industry that we presented to them, and they confirmed that they would prefer a local supply chain. However, it would have to be competitive, it would have to be secure, but they would prefer to have an international partner, of which we have a very interesting example. They also said that they believe our companies are not competitive, that the reject rates are too high, and these are areas that the NFG has been supporting the industry with. They say that future castings will be more complex, concerned that we would be falling behind here, and they would like to see investment by foundries and engagement with international partners. Overall conclusions, many foundries in the supply chain have benefited from the NFG initiatives. Smaller foundries have seen increased volumes. Production foundries are qualified to international standards. There are no new model orders. Volumes are too small to be competitive, but significant opportunities exist. Customers believe our foundries are not competitive and want to see investment. Our conclusion was it would require significant intervention. Why is aluminium so important to the transport sector? And I think it goes right down to legislation that came out already in the 70s in the UN in America, requiring the reduction in GHG, or even called exhaust gases and GHG emissions, and reducing weight of vehicles, one route to achieve this. And you can also address the drivetrain and the type of fuels, the greenhouse gases. And I'm not going to go through all the wonderful properties of aluminium, suffice to say it's one third the weight of steel and it's the strongest steel. And that is what's big attraction. When we identified this, we anticipated a very, very significant increase in the demand for aluminium scrap, and that's exactly what's taken place over the past 20 years. The table at the bottom shows that in 1999, there would be 89 kilograms of aluminium in a vehicle. By 2025, that was predicted in 2010 to go to 168. I was at a conference in America last month where I don't believe that. In fact, the numbers we pushed up by 47% to 250 kilograms per vehicle. And if you consider that they'll be producing over 100 million cars a year, it's a huge amount of scrap. Now, Vision 2020, everybody I'm sure knows this, that currently we produce 600,000 vehicles per year in South Africa. We want to push that up to 1.2 million by the end of the decade, and want to increase local content from 30% to 60 to 65%. That is the Vision 22, 2020 of the APTB update from 2 weeks ago at the localization in Narva in Durban. One of the top speakers, key speaker, was said that the global automotive industry represents a major development for South African-based component manufacturers on an opportunity. Intense international competition does exist. And he posed the first key question is, will South Africa be a manufacturer or assembler? As a manufacturer, we would see deep localization of component manufacturer, and I can anticipate that going to 60-65% local content. As assembler, there would be the more limited localization. He reported on the results of local purchases from 2013 to 2014, and that would be on all sectors. An overall localization increased by about 0.4%. Eight sectors increased, and I just mentioned a few: trim, metal, presents, electronics, and plastic molding. However, three sectors showed a decline, including foundries and forges, really just supporting our own findings of before. And then key question number two was, can South Africa be a manufacturer of vehicles if it fails to build its foundries and forges? Our view is that castings are essential to any manufacturing sector. Our challenge is to maintain and grow the remaining foundries and the scrap at a preferential price. We need to make the industry more competitive. I would like to give some feedback on that. And when that preferential pricing regulation was introduced in 2013, which is at the time of our survey, and some of the automotive sectors representatives we spoke to were very excited by this. They said this could really be the opportunity. Frustration is that it's not happening. And what we see immediately from this slide, why it's so important, aluminium, the raw material is 40% of the cost, so 20 or 25% will usually have a 10% impact on the bottom line of the cost of the component, and that would then make the difference. In conclusion, thank you. The interventions have been successful, they've been a valuable contribution to the industry, they've ensured survival of some foundries, they've upgraded equipment and skills to make them more competitive. We've got international know-how, and this is the foundation for future expansion. The challenge is now just to hold what we've got. Thank you.
No, thank you, Mr. Chris. And thank you to all of those who have already made their presentations. What I would like to ask those who have already done that, I asked you not to generalize, and you did then begin to specify, I remember the black industrialist one, and more recently you referred to a couple, I think, Mr. Chris or Mercedes Dot. Would you please bring them up to the table, the name, write down the name and the province in which they are in. There were four of them all together. That is important to us. Thank you very much. Now, members, thank you for your patience. This is a very, very critical component of industrial policy, industrialization. It is absolutely critical. And I think the point is made, are we going to continue to just assemble, or will we grow our manufacturing base? This is what's at risk here. So I'd like you to take your tea now, just a few minutes before 11:30, and to please return here as 11:45, so we can continue with Transnet and Barsa. Thank you very much to all of you. Because you will be responding to questions now, and be advisable for you to come a little bit forward. You seem to be right there in the back. Thank you. successor, Honourable Yester Hazen from the IMP has just joined us, Honourable Colonel.
So, thank you very much, President. I'd like to welcome the presentation from all the organizations and representatives. I will ask you that question because the presentations were similar to each other and they were provoking the same questions to me. So I will ask those questions so people will do. I'm asking the question so you can respond accordingly. The fundamental challenge at the presentation is a decline of self-image. One of the reasons that have been put for advance is the question of uncompetitiveness of software. What is it that we're doing wrong? Or what is it that we're not doing right? That makes us to be less competitive in terms of the programs. What do you think that's what we want? That's the first one. I'm asking these questions because every time people are referring also to economies of scale. Another example into motivating in terms of the economies of scale is the matter that there is level of volume to achieve. The economy is our production capacity that is a problem. Because I wrote it in an economic question, is it the cost of capital? Or is it the availability of the amounts of finance to support manufacturing? What is my rate that we are dealing with here? Are we dealing with the question of the cost of capital is expensive? That means it's less as we invest into production and new plan, what is the issue? Because I know one of it is the skills we have. When I'm looking here about the skill gap, I see that you only registered the trades with the South African Qualifications Authority in 2018. From 2003, to 2013, we did not reach the South African Qualifications Authority. And how will we proceed these engineers, these assistants, and so forth with our foundation? One of your reports saying that, from 2013, that is 10 years lost in terms of all that. So maybe you can give me those variables. Specific question is the question of this competitiveness. Improvement initiative, a general issue that is being done across the sector, or is only for the frontmen as an institution? Is it in all other sectors? We accepted that we need to localize, but in terms of the conference that was attended, in terms of saying that localization is declining in terms of the funds. Because my question is going to be related to the comment of the chairperson. Chairperson also mentioned sector is being funded by the DPI like any other thing. There are many things that we put to make sure that this industry does not go down. But what is the problem? Okay, no, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nkongi, Honorable McPherson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the honest assessment from the presenters. And I'll give you my assessment. I think in 10 to 20 years' time, you're not going to have an industry left if things continue the way that they are. And I think one of the most horrifying slides came from the National Foundry Technology Network, number 24. When they detail the combined cost structure in terms of percentages, and interesting that the input materials is the lowest out of the BRICS countries, in overheads as a combined the cases is the highest. And we know from experience that any small business trying to make its way through a competitive market, a globally competitive market, that has to deal with those sorts of overheads, is not going to survive. I mean, and it's very, very evident that when one looks at the South African Institute of Foundrymen, and they start to break down where the problems have come in, I'm quite sure the closure of those foundries are probably small to medium sized foundries. And I mean, to see that bar KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng, the number of foundries is halved in every other province. And in Mpumalanga it's gone from 15 to 2 in the space of 8 years. And that speaks to a crisis. It's a crisis in industry that is battling to survive. And I think that one of the chief reasons for that is the cost of overheads. I mean, and we can see that in every other sector across South Africa, so it's not surprising that we're seeing it here. You know, when labor is 53% of your overhead cost, no wonder you can't survive in a globally competitive market. But I think the reason that you're here is obviously to bring this to our attention and for us to see what the challenges are and how they adjust. But my question to you is there an industry to be saved? Can it be saved? Can it exist in the current framework and the current overhead costs? And how do you begin to do that when we are benchmarking ourselves against other BRICS countries, such as that slide 24 is? So thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Colonel.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just quickly, three questions. I want to reiterate what the Honourable Konki was saying. Why? Why are we struggling? If it was not the global crisis, if it was not the supply of the electricity in the country, what are the other reasons why are we struggling? Secondly, if we look at Brazil and India, do they have better tariff protection than us? Is that a problem, the tariffs? And then finally, do you see an opportunity for your industry in terms of Africa? Will the, if there is growth in Africa, as we see it every day and every year, is the opportunity for you?
Thank you, Honourable Quero. Honourable Yves Sarenson, how is it?
Thank you, Chair. Both the trend and permanent bulk foundries or the challenges that you face are actually, firstly, largely with the energy and low emission problems, I would say. On the smeltery side, the design of the combustion equipment, there's usually a gap, you know, everyone pulling away from electricity. Also, the new technology has been improved that in the smeltery side, the furnace side, the possibility of combusting gas that helps, that's a very big massive saver in energy. That's usually caused by preheating the recuperator. Also, on the challenge, I think that we have a shortfall on the metallurgic operations of the steel and the rolling side. If you do bright bars, for example, bright bars where or hollow bars where ID and OT is of critical value on this thing, there we need a temperature uniformity of the steel. The decarbonization with like normal mild steel, it's basically no carbon content, and the high carbon steel. So we need a uniformity of the temperatures in foundries. I actually studied engineering, but women rugby, and I dropped the Opus Corps. But I went to the technical college and I did a project actually in the metallurgical industry for a while. And also something here, why I'm mentioning this, that if you don't mention here, the safety in this industry. There was always some explosion or something wrong in the foundry site. And there's two tip locks on a furnace, for example, the hot one, the scale one, and the metal one, and there was always an explosion there. You people haven't mentioned the safety aspect, and anyone, the presentation so far. There's also ionic fluids that are starting to be used in the foundry industry. This is a sodium chloride fluid that contains that expands over 300 degrees Celsius. That means actually there's no vapor pressure below the composition temperature of the fluid actually, which gives you more water is obviously the one that they use and a better flow than this, and it's much cheaper. But for critical for those dimensions of the sizes that I said that I've seen also not that we have the challenges that we mentioned. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Uncle Esterhaver. A couple of pointers that have come out here is that you all seem to make the point when time and trouble was taken and experts in a particular field were brought in, you were able to reduce energy consumption and the intensity of it. When you realize, well, if we don't train anyone, we'll be bringing back 70-year-olds. The committee went up 10 years ago to spread the story. Why aren't you training? Why aren't you training? Your youngest person in any of these places was 40 years old. And what does that tell you? And now, please respond to some of these. The issue around scrap that we have raised, that you have raised, becomes absolutely critical with respect to energy, but also with respect to the fact that I see in aluminium that 40% of this material is made up in it would be better utilized to scrap aluminium, etc. In terms of the colleges, there don't seem to be enough. You know, you say you're producing 10, 12, 15. That's nothing. That's hardly a radical transformation in any way whatsoever. Now, I would like to know, when you respond to the questions raised by Mkongi and others, what are the impediments? Can't you find these people? Can't you find them? Secondly, someone mentioned they have career days that they are part of or hold them. Well, the first time I've heard of a career day in a factory. We've got loads of young people in Harjing. I haven't even seen any of them invited. So who are you inviting to this career day? I haven't even seen it advertised. It's advertised in the material and social network that young people are using. I doubt it. The other thing is you need to come back in writing, all of you, and tell us what strategies you put in place to address the skills deficit. The other thing is the certification, but let me leave that. You said one of you indicated that competition can be addressed. We must deepen localization. We must address the scrap issue. Let's come forward with some constructive ideas. I can see that you've been grappling with this now, and come forward. It's not too late. When a country goes to war, it doesn't have 10 years to prepare. It has a couple of months to get their act together, otherwise they would lose that war. Now I suggest you wake up and realize we are fighting a war in this area. It's not business as usual. Thank you. Now, anyone who wants to respond to that, please do so. Just raise your hand and speak. and you're in the floor for 4 minutes. There was rust, the stainless, is it? Click. Just give your name.
Sorry, this is Steve Daly. Musical mind, sorry about that. But I'm sure I think to all these questions, I agree. Is one needs to take bull by the horns and address the issues where they lie. We certainly, I agree, we have a war on our hands, and we need strategy to take us forward. United we stand is something that's said very often, but in actual fact, it's an absolute must. So I certainly think that when we talk about the coordination and collaboration, it's an absolute essential part of what needs to happen into pulling this whole group of activities together. In the question that was raised in terms of the competitiveness gap and the defining sector, very often decisions are not made necessarily in this country. So we have seen foundries that are declining because of the fact that technologies have even passed us in global markets, and we haven't necessarily localized that technology. As a result of it, we are training people into older technologies. So we are definitely training people into an arrears focus. The economy of scale certainly is a big issue. Primarily, in my view, it's come down to a risk factor rather than just simply to the cost of capital. Because when you're talking about the volume across one industry, let's talk rail here. You've got 3,600 coaches over 10 years. Translating, but you take it down to per day, per month, all of a sudden the volume comes right down. And one's got to look at what kind of volume you need to sustain, the kind of investment you need to make. And secondly, is that investment on the same scale that you can actually compete with some of the overseas competitors? So the way to compete certainly is to look at what the South African market actually has to offer. The fact that the DGI has designated some of these products means it gives you a chance to actually look at what needs to be done to localize products and to develop the capacity. To assume that you don't go into a 30-year gap and bring in the technologies and just get things going next day, it's not going to happen. There's going to be a time taken to actually develop each and every foundry, best by best, in order to make sure that you get to a point where you can actually provide the products that the different buyers are looking for. Similarly, in the automotive sector, we've got to be strategic in terms of what it is that we actually want to manufacture in the country. And there's certainly some products, most of these are obviously, all of these foundries are generally private loans, so as a result, they're looking at the risk of manufacturing in Africa versus the risk of manufacturing in China or anywhere else. And the sustainability of what they're going to do. So the business confidence in the country is obviously going to have huge advantages in terms of some of those decisions. But nonetheless, it doesn't mean that we can't build capacity. It means that we need to identify what we have and make sure that we eliminate the erosion. So just an example, perhaps the fact that maybe 100,000 bogies to be built over a 10-year period between locomotives, coaches, and wagons. If we localize every single one of those, what number of jobs are we going to actually secure and what kind of revenue are we going to secure into the country? How many components can we manufacture? Every one of those components that we import, whether it be in a fully built up vehicle or whether it be in a broken down form, in component, whatever it might be, erodes that opportunity. So those are the decisions we need to make as a team, I think. The ability to intervene and to provide a response in every instance, I think it's been shown that there is capacity in many of these different products that are actually produced in the country. But it is true is that, as the slide indicated, we're not necessarily competitive in that we are not in charge of our costs. I would suggest that one of the challenges we have as South Africans, we generally too easy to spend money before we actually start to ask continuing questions in terms of whether this is a competitive price we actually pay. We will buy a cheaper product, whether it's imported or local. We will not necessarily consider when we buy something and we ask for a 10% increase. Well, what have you done to actually reduce costs over the last year or 5 years, whatever? What are you doing as a collective in order to stand in union against increases which are coming through to us? If I would say, look at some of the material costs, I don't know of any buyer carpenters that are out there in any industry. those are the forums that you can actually use in order to get those deals. The challenge that we've got when if you ask the question, is there an industry to be saved? Absolutely. I think we've got some very brave and courageous people out there who are trying very hard in order to not only make things work for themselves, but in order to actually make the future for their offspring. Many of these are family owned businesses. These are first, second, or third generation companies. The light I would like to emphasize is the fact is that there are family-owned families who are incredibly entrepreneurial and they've been successful. I think that's worth it, actually thank these people.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jardine. Who else wishes to come in there? Yes, please give your name before you speak.
My name is John Davis. I'm the CEO of South African Institute of Farming. I perhaps just wanted to take, Madam Chair, the opportunity to respond just briefly on the issue of uncompetitiveness that has been commonly raised. I don't think that there is a lot that one would say other than that there is a multifactorial issue in most cases resulting in closure of farmers. And I believe that in trying to compete on price, the local industry will probably fail. Because we know that whatever the price is in South Africa, there's a lower imported price coming from one of the low-cost manufacturing zones in the East. So my view is that we should look at all the other elements. In other words, what I call a value proposition for local foundries to service their customers. And there are a number of issues that in fact can be addressed, which include much better supply chain management in terms of inventories, looking at opportunities with regards to responsiveness and agility in terms of the volumes that are required, and more particularly to have design capabilities so that in fact a better product can be produced that would be lower in weight, in particular therefore lower energy consumption. I just wanted to, the other questions that were raised regarding the capital cost and the cost of capital, I think it really is a question of probably both of those for many of the small and medium-sized farmers. The access to the capital and then the cost of the capital is important. And just lastly, just in response to the skills gap, I need to say that we had trades in place and there was some training that was taking place in the industry, but not enough, not sufficient to fill the gap. And a lot of that is due to the fact that the training of officers, as I'm sure everyone is aware, really went into decline during the 1990s, and it's really only now starting to emerge again from 2011 as being a key focus point for both industry and for the Department of Higher Education. And the time taken to have the registration of the curricula really was a bit short because we were revising the existing curricula for trades. We were looking at firstly a learnership and then an artisanship program. So there was a number of say, impediments that got in the space of those 10 years. And let me say that it was somewhat of a roller coaster, and I'm very pleased to say that we finally managed to get the trades registered in the new curricula form, looking at the new needs of industry rather than, in fact, the old requirements that the old trade test used to require. And then just finally, if I may, Madam Chair, the question of the career day, it is a fact. We do advertise these career days in the local area, and at the last opportunity, we had well over 100 aspirants learners that came along, and from those 100, 20 new recruits were taken in this year for training at the Gauteng Foundry Training Center. So it's local, and there are strict criteria to screen the candidates. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davies. Is there anyone else who wishes to add to that and respond? Well, certainly don't be shy, yeah. You know, you've got an opportunity now to help us understand some of the challenges you face. So, you know, you've shared a lot with us. What are these other challenges? Well, how are you responding that you never had the time to tell us?
Maybe Dr. Davies, Mr. Davies, yes, he's just put that down. So that is the response being from industry. We'll get the response in this area now from DTI, thank you. Mrs. Pelle.
I think that was level for the issue of are we as an industry together with ourselves really training to meet the needs of the industry? Mr. David has a really important issue about the evolution of the curriculum development. As you know, the Department of Higher Education introduced new institutions, introduced the way the new qualifications and occupational aspects to be done moving forward. And it took a bit of time to institutionalize the system in order to deliver what the industry is looking for. And as I said when I was presenting, us as a DTI we got involved in the issue of skills development, not because we want to train, but it's important in the element of competitiveness and sustaining the industry going forward. I highlighted the issue about the registration, the accreditation of the new trades into the mainstream. Because as an industry and ourselves as a DTI, we can only do that in a pilot format. In order for us to hit the numbers that we are looking for, training thousands, hundreds of students going forward, it has to be in the mainstream of the education system going forward, so that the Department of Higher Education can offer that, you know, on a systematic basis. To this end, what we have been doing together with industry was to pilot elements of the change, the new change that we have developed. So going forward, in order for the school to be a big program that we can change the faith and the integration in the engineering industry has to be integrated into the mainstream. On the issue of competitiveness, I think the industry concept has on us. For us, volume demand goes together. You know, we can talk a lot about how we're going to improve competitiveness, how we're going to hit the skills that we are looking for. It's a combination of what do we do at the factory level, how are we finding markets, how are we increasing demand. And unfortunately, in this industry, some of them are really dependent on the building of the infrastructure. As a country, we went through dips in our infrastructure development, which resulted in some decrease in economic activity in the industries such as the ones that we are talking about. If we are picking up on the spend on the infrastructure, we believe that then it has to be as a whole, a part of us regarding change should be coupled with how, what kind of an industry are we developing here in the infrastructure. So it's a collective, a teamwork kind of approach that we need to tackle the issue. If we're going to do in a piecemeal, we're going to miss opportunities, we're going to need the ability to deal with some of the challenges that are within the industry. Issues of capital, access to capital, the cost of capital, we are working together with institutions such as the Industrial Development Corporation to look at how can we provide issues such as working capital at a more competitive rate. How do we improve the package of incentives from the DTIC so that if somebody walks in and entrepreneur wants to build a factory, how do we going to help the entrepreneur to realize the opportunities? So it's about how we package everything that we do. I think within pockets of the state, we have elements of contribution to that within the vision conversation. But if we do it independently, it's not going to amount to what we are looking for. It has a collective work going forward. Is this an industry that is rotating, as I've indicated? We can't talk about the payment industry without the funding industry.
Right. Thank you very much, Chief Director. We will be engaging with you again on this matter. But right now, at 12:15, we're going to move over to transport, as it were. I see going to have to reduce the time that we give people. The tool making, we're going to give you 15 minutes, please, and then we'll engage with you. All right? And we've got with the tool makers here, Mr. Mkiza and Mr. Mandeep, who is the CEO, who will make the presentation. Well, that be yourself, Mr. Mkiza. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Madam Chair, and Honourable Minister of the House. Thank you for the opportunity. I'd like to introduce the Trade Association of South Africa, TASA, and then my colleague Dan will also give the presentation on the Ensuring National Trade Initiative Program. The role of TASA, the role of TASA in the Ensuring NTI partnership with the DGI. I'd like to give you a quick background. Basically, when we refer to the TDS, so we refer to the tools, dyes, modes, genes, and features. All right, thank you. I'd like to give a short background. Tools, dyes, modes, genes, and features. And that's why we refer to the center. Actually, we have this presence in the gene, because it's also the part of the center. And actually, the TDM center enables all manufacturing. The TDM center, in this region of Africa, as both the previous presentation has shown that on the centers. This is mainly caused by the skills gap, which has been discussed about 10 minutes ago, competitiveness decline, lack of transformation, and lack of support. And I think I will put the hidden from the view center. I think why because the transfer is not specifically in the mainstream, but it doesn't matter whatever technology you do, you still need a tool to process that. If we look at sector statistics, we have more than 500 local companies which are involved in direct to the supply chain. In terms of the market, the local manufacturing sector, and OEMs and so on, we talked about over 15 billion dollars, with less than 30% of this demand is actually sourced locally. Split is about automotive, we're talking about 50% or more, packaging in the region of 35%, and other, such as mining, medical, and aerospace, is about 15%. In terms of employment in this subsector, which is a tooling, looking at the direct employment of over 6,000, but it is estimated that one TM sector job will actually support 20 downstream jobs. That is according to the fixed time, which was done in 2005. In terms of the representation, TASA is a 1,900 company. We represent industry through the 6 provincial chapters, where the TASA is active. Our objective and the main objective of TASA is we seek to promote the importance of the TM sector in support of the industry programs which I have objectives. Approximately 25% of the TDM sector companies participate in the association. But, this may sound small, but this is a challenge globally. If you compare it to other countries, company will actually participate, so those are the trends. In closing, I would like to thank the committee to allow the task to introduce this. Thank you.
Chairperson, honourable members, I'd like to introduce another DGI industry partnership program, which is called the NCME National Tool Initiative of South Africa. This is a program engineered to help with the turnaround of the demise of the tool dyeing sector in South Africa, to improve the sector's competitiveness, to drive economic growth and job creation in the broader, in support of
pipelines manufacturing objectives. The two main focus areas of this program is firstly the redevelopment and alignment of South Africa's steel delivery capacity in this area of advanced manufacturing with that of leading industrialized manufacturing economy globally. I think this is where a lot of the discussion has been this morning. There's not a very good understanding of South Africa's capacity to develop skills, autonomy specifically, versus the requirements of the modern, highly advanced manufacturing sector, what is going to look like in the future, and what are the type of skills in the complete value chain that industry is going to be requiring. And I'd like to illustrate that by means of what we are doing on this program. Secondly, is to provide focused enterprise development support to small, medium, and micro enterprises in the sector through things like benchmarking, showing companies what their positions are relative to their international competition, what are the areas where we are failing, and how to create interventions in those areas to change the environment in local companies so that we can solve these problems we've been discussing at length. So if we then look at the skill system across the entire skill value chain of the sector, it's a fallacy to think that we're going to create artisans and solve the manufacturing sector's problems. That is exactly where we're making a big mistake. The innovation capacity required in the future in manufacturing, as it has been driven by the 10 top manufacturing economies of the world, is focused on something that we call talent-driven innovation. And I want to illustrate that by an example to say, if we want to produce the next Michael Schumacher Formula One racing driver champion, we can't just pack the first 10 people that are interested in racing off the street and we stick them in a program and we're going to make them racing drivers. We have to specifically put attention to sourcing talent, to look for the right motoring skills and eye coordination, whatever it is that makes a good racing driver. We have to find that talent in young people and then develop their skills as a racing driver. This is exactly the same in advanced manufacturing. We cannot just keep on pushing people into a system, sausage machine, and producing people with certificates in their hands. It's not going to create innovation capacity. So the type of engineers, designers, project managers, researchers, technicians, artisans, and even entry-level factory workers we need is different in the future to what we've done in the past. Therefore, the mainstream system for producing these skills in South Africa has been inadequate to give us what we want. That's where the skills gap is originating from. That's why we had to do this intervention in partnership with GDI, even though they were reluctant to do it, to demonstrate by example on a large enough scale that how do we need to do this in order to give us what we want. So this program called the National Dream Initiative set out to go and create the system, to source that talent, to identify the right people into the system, and then to put the right skills into the hands of the people, from entry-level factory workers right up to engineering level. But that meant we had to innovate the system, because this system does not exist or did not exist in South Africa. It does now, but you have to go further. You have to give all the theoretical, practical, and workplace integrated training to young people in order to equip them correctly. But job placement and migration management is part of the job. We cannot just stick certificate in people's hands and think it's going to happen by job. Career path tracking, continuous development, but the very important thing, we are manufacturing in a global environment against the Chinese, the Americans, the Germans. So whatever we're doing must have international standards or international accreditation. How many people are in future going to have to go to Brazil to install some of our tooling in the plant there that we manufacture here? They need to understand our skills, recognize them, and we need to be as competitive, if not better, than them in order to do this. So in order to achieve such a feat, we have to form very extensive partnerships. First, starting with the GDI, but we took that down to 6 provincial Department of Economic Development partnerships. Even local with the city of Tshwane, we've got a very extensive partnership, and we engaged the
educational environment. 15 elite colleges across 6 provinces, 4 universities, and we successfully, over and above that, set up 3 industry-based schooling centers of excellence and 3 international partnerships with Germany and the USA to help build this complete value chain delivery system from entry level to engineering skills. We spoke about transformation earlier. More than 80% of the people currently driving the schooling sector in South Africa are 48 years and older. They've been there for a very long time. They are no longer driving innovation in the sector. They're on the exit. So we have to provide on a large scale new entrants into the industry that's going to be the future factory owners, that's going to be the innovators, that will be the designers and engineers. So we have the ideal opportunity to redress transformation in the sector. So we in the tooling sector have currently over 1,600 learners in the system, building the pipeline in 6 provinces, 98% from previously disadvantaged environments, more than 75% backend people, less than 2% white in this program of ours. But importantly, 20% of them are from rural communities. We've proven we can take people from Sekokuni and Mpopo, from the weaker school system, and address their gaps and put them successfully into a career path in the tooling sector. 30% females, never happens in nowhere across the world are there females in tool development. We have 30% in our program and they're qualifying successfully on international standard qualifications. 80% retention rate, more than 85% of our young people exiting are in permanent jobs by the time they exit because of how we develop them. Over 200 companies nationally are participating, during training, taking these young people, but also in placing them post qualification. So that, we believe, is a long-term solution to this specific sector's skills needs. And because we've entrenched the system and this pipeline delivery, we will, over the next 2 years from now, shift the focus from the skill side to the enterprise side so that we can develop these enterprises so that we can put more of these young people into the system and take them up into the industry. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lucinda. You the two both came at the right point where all the questions were being raised around the issue of skilling, upgrading of skills, providing specialized skills across the board, and to those communities and individuals who have not had that opportunity before. We will be putting a number of questions to you in this regard just to clarify that, but for the benefit just of the members, the TVEG, as you know, are technical, vocational, and education and training. We have to, because of time, move on to PASA and PASNet. It's fortunate that IPAP will be with us for 4 years solidly, and we will engage you from time to time, at least every 4 months in this area. So even if you don't all come, you can get representatives coming along in this area. It is something we have to track and to see how far you've implemented the commitments we've seen here and heard you make. So we are going to track you. If we don't track you by inviting you here, we will ask you to respond to certain questions, but where possible, to come and engage with us. Ms. Naidu is now just getting, is it Transnet and PASA, but where are they? Where are those two? Can you come forward, please, quickly, because we'd like to give you 45 minutes, the two of you. That means a 15-minute presentation from each of you, followed by some questions and engagement. So who will be starting first?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the honourable members. I have with me, I'm Gary Peter. I'm the Acting Group Chief Finance Officer for Transnet. I have with me Mr. Edward Thomas, who's the Group Chief Supply Chain Officer. He'll be taking us through most of the presentations, but if I could just highlight the contents. We'll be talking about our connections with today's ICAP, as well as the progress made on local content. And we'll also highlight the achievements made today on other areas, other than just locomotives and waves, to highlight what we're doing as a place of localization. momentum shall put enterprise development in terms of how we're supporting local businesses, especially SMEs and grain needs. So if I can move to this slide three, we understand that from a logic point of view, our supply development process embodies the clear policy that government has actually highlighted in terms of addressing some of the nation's challenges, such as job creation, skill development, and industrialization. Our supply development program is all-encompassing. It doesn't just focus on job creation, it looks at policy areas, and we introduce these areas in our tenders, and we actually provide a little guidance to the businesses to ensure that they implement that, to try and create impact. We all know that there's a massive check around running stock. You'll see on slide 5, we have 55% of diesel locomotives, 60% of electric, and 80% of wagons. We'll be talking about that and how we actually do that in our tender process. I'd like to try to slide 5, we also have specific disadvantages for certain key components, and we'll also be highlighting how we've actually awarded these tenders against these local content requirements. So for all tenders, trying to include these local content requirements. But it doesn't just include local content. It looks at those other areas. It looks at skill development. It looks at how business are going to improve their black ownership, as an example. And we are always assessing the extent of localization potential in other commodities, depending on our level. So, for example, on page 6, we're looking at working with the Department of Trade and Industry around how we can localize overhead track equipment, as well as engineering. So we've done some research. We currently mine an approved list, but the detail is engaging with customers, with manufacturers, and the supply base to understand to what extent we could localize these two components. And based on that, we will then determine the feasibility of designation and chances to then include the local content changes that the design conclude on and put that in our tables. So our focus on localization, if you look at slide 8, is not just focused on localization itself, but it has to ensure sustainability. And we've identified three key pillars to ensure sustainability. Skills development is number one. Skills are prerequisite to capability. We've also looked at IT and technology transfer in order to be able to efficiently and sustainably manufacture locally. It helps you, the OEMs, if they don't get forced through our tender process to provide IT and technology transfer, our local suppliers will never have the design capability to be able to create their own export potential. And then the OEMs will always stretch them in terms of their growth. Because they don't want competition at the end of the day. It's our duty to leverage our procurement spend to force these OEMs to create the benefit in our downstream suppliers in South Africa. Lastly, investments in plant assets is critical. It's a key part of local manufacturing capability. So we've actually included skill development, IT and technology transfer, and investments in plants in our tenders. And we asked all suppliers to give us a supply and development plan as to how they are going to be impacting on these areas and in delocalization. So it's not just the local content threshold we ask for. We dive all of these areas. Maybe to explain a little bit better on slide 9, Transit has a bottom-up and a top-down approach to enterprise and supplier development. We have a strategic approach where we focus on our tier 1 suppliers to influence them to engage local tier 2 and tier 3 suppliers. So in this example, we've used General Electric, which is one of the OEMs in our locomotive program. Through these large locomotive programs, we are driving obligations to partner local manufacturers. For example, here we have Sierra Heimler in Germany. GE helped train a lot of the staff members in Sierra Heimler, accredited them according to GE practices. And Sierra Heimler now provides services to GE, not just the transcontinental pricing, locomotive coaches, but also in its global supply chain, which shows you South Africans can be competitive on the global stage, and GE has actually seen that. And then from a bottom-up point of view, partially we support Sierra Heimler Engineering through preferential procurement and enterprise development. So that will be partnering with the OEMs to try and drive down supply development, and then we ourselves are also buying goods and equipment from these suppliers and helping them from an enterprise development point of view. Maybe just on slide 10, to touch on the fact that we look at four key areas of opportunity that could be leveraged in order to develop our local supply base. We analyze the market before we go out on tender to determine what is missing. Is there a basic level of skill, or is the market quite mature? If the market is quite mature, we will include supply development obligations around manufacturing of components and upgrades, as well as system and subsystem machines. That makes, obviously, potential for export. If the market is relatively immature, we will start at targeting skill development and then driving to the next level of repairs and maintenance capabilities. But the important point is that supply development opportunities present themselves across the entire value chain. There is opportunity for localization, regardless of the maturity of industry.
it just depends on what level and how much leverage we have as an entity. The thing about trying to leverage is our market, the more establishing capital investment program over the next 7 years. You'll recall that in the President and State of the Nation address in 2012, he introduced the market demand strategy, which is a rolling 7-year capital investment program. It was then around 300 million rand. That has since increased to 336.6 million rand, and 2/3 of that, interestingly, will be spent in the rolling stock sector. So that gives you the biggest opportunity for liberalization and industrialization. And then we're going to be entering where we have entered into long-term contracts, and these long-term contracts provide a supply base with certainty and a stable pattern of demand so that they can invest in plants and equipment and skills and in art and technology. Lastly, before I hand over to my colleague who will go into some details of the subsidiaries, on slide 12, we also highlighted that looking at common technologies in rolling stock, there are common components such as your bogies, brake systems, underbanks, and covers, which are in locomotives as well as brakes. So we consolidated that market to try and give the market a bigger opportunity to be able to invest and to localize. I'm going to hand over to Ed Thomas, who will just take us through the progress on the locomotive programs, as was a recent question previously from one of the honourable members, as well as the wagon procurement.
Thank you very much. In terms of the locomotive program, the 9520 electric locomotive tender that was awarded to CSR, these locomotives have been completed in the assembly and are rolling in our general freight business. And in terms of the tender was issued before the contracts we had exemption from the triple PLA. But in terms of the staff, we still push hard to make sure that we achieve a lot in terms of supply development. In terms of what we actually achieve on this contract, we achieve 67% of contract value we have achieved for supply development value. In terms of capacity and capability, the intention of Transnet was for us actually to create local assembly capability for electric locomotives. And we did achieve this in Transnet Engineering. We also had a fair amount of investment in plant, which is part of industrialization. On the next page, I'm listing a couple of about 11 suppliers, South African local suppliers, who actually benefited from this transaction. And you'll see out of these suppliers, 7 out of the 11 have significant land ownership. We've got companies like Siamba, which Gary mentioned. They 90% black owners, and they had a large portion of work in the contract. DCE, First National Battery, proceeds. All of these companies have good black ownership, and it is achieving the objective of creating sustainable economic industry in South Africa. Transnet Engineering also played a key role. This was the first electric locomotives assembled by Transnet Engineering, and it was quite successful. They did a lot of body work. We basically created 275 jobs. We, Transnet Engineering, also achieved training of 110 individuals in the organization, focusing around car body manufacturing preparation, material preparation and assembly, as well as some more technologically advanced items, such as the driver desk and the local commission and testing technologies. On the 1064 locomotive transaction, this is the largest locomotive tender in the world, 1,064 locomotives, EAU is just over 50 billion rand. And this is in support of the general freight business in terms of where Transnet is moving to try and move freight from road to rail. This is going to be a massive support in terms of that sector. Also, we basically got a mix of electric and diesel locomotives, and that was awarded to these 4 OEMs. The local content requirements have been met by these suppliers in terms of their commitment to the local content. The process we are currently is the designs have been now finalized and approved about a month to 2 months ago. So what this means now is the OEMs are now going to go and finalize their local suppliers in terms of who's going to be assisting them in the manufacturing of the various components, sub-assemblies for the assembly of the locomotives in South Africa. You see there on slide 22, we state 60% plus. we are averaging about 70% of the contract value for supply development value. Now, obviously, because we are still in the final stages around the contracting stages for local content and supply development, we can't give clear specifics, but we will be achieving around about an average of 70% of the contract value. Also, just in terms of some of the estimates, in terms of job creation, job maintenance, number of people being developed, we're looking in excess of 6,000 jobs created, 5,000 jobs maintained. And this is effectively as a result of the deep spend that Transnet is making on these locomotives. The locomotives will obviously be geographically assembled in two areas, one cutting around the Pittsburgh area, and then also two of the local manufacturers will be setting up shop in KZN in Durban. And we're expecting a massive economical impact on these areas, where you will actually have a wide radius of impact in terms of certain downstream suppliers getting involved, all your small enterprises being actually getting the opportunity to do work in these environments. The delivery schedule is, as you can see on the slide, we're starting to tell you to receive delivery in the next month or so, and then it'll ramp up and accelerate all the way through 2016-2017 with the final locomotives delivered in March 2018. It's a very aggressive program, and we do believe that the industry in South Africa can support this and localize and support the business transfer needs. In terms of the rail infrastructure commodities, rails are turning out currently only 10% local. We are driving some of our existing contracts, and we are developing strategies where we want to look over a long-term period, 2 to 5 years, to achieve 100% localization of our rails and our turnouts. We're also working hard on the fastening systems, and as well as sleepers. Ballast is local, and that's basically your aggregate that you easily need to lay the track on. But obviously, you want to grow our supply base of the ballast. And also, another opportunity is around overhead track wire, machinery, where we want to get some percent of the content. But we also want to drive technology improvements in these areas. Obviously, other areas we are looking at is signaling, etc., as Larry had mentioned earlier. In terms of our web localization, we've got four key components in a web. You've got your bogies, your body, your brakes, and your gear. Now, the bogies consist of wheels, axles, bearings, your car components, springs. Your body consists basically of steel and welding. Your brakes is the blocks, the pipe, and the testing. And then your raw gear, couplers, knuckles, and yokes. And in terms of local content, we are going to achieve over our current contract that we have awarded over a period of 24 to 36 months, 100% local content on the majority of these items. As you'll see on slide 29, with the brake blocks, there are certain issues that the suppliers have indicated, where they've identified that certain of the materials in the manufacture of brake blocks are solely imported. And then these materials are not available in South Africa. We are working with them to get the identification of potential alternates, if there are any. But also, we've got an issue around the brake blocks and locomotives. The volume of brake blocks and locomotives does not support creating an industry, but where the brake blocks on wagon and coaches between us and Prasa, there is definitely a large opportunity. In terms of Transnet achievements to date, there's been a lot of supply developments implemented. I'm going to touch briefly on a couple of them. You'll see this page just gives a summary of AVOC companies. But also, people say supply development comes at a cost. And you'll see on slide 32 on key some of the key components where we've actually done benchmarking exercises versus prices awarded on these transactions where we're looking for massive key obligations as well as localization. And you can see on these key items that we actually achieve contract prices that meet the benchmark or are even in instances lower than the benchmark. I think we all know about EME satellite neutral action where we have localization around fabrication, bogies, etc. Now this is obviously moving along further in terms of our new locomotives where we are looking at more commodities. You know, historically we had the GE transaction, we had the SUNY transaction where there was local content, there was jobs created, jobs preserved, skills development. I mean, as Barry mentioned, you know, one key areas on capturing localization is skills, technology, and investment in plant. You know, it's not just any single item. In terms of EMD, we also had localization. Even on the trains, we had local content, skill development. On Reason, it's basically a 100% transform company, you know, in terms of manufacturing bearings for us. You know, they created new jobs. It was 18 million rand investment in plants, and they can handle 143,000 units per annum. Now, they created jobs and for the country as well as developed skills. In terms of Naledi, 34-inch wheels for Transnet. It is also forged wheels which can support passenger coaches. In terms of this, we achieved 560 million rand supply development value on this transaction. There's 139 million rand investment in block that is happening here. And we also score, we also achieving 1 billion rand of supply development value with a lot of local content and development of the products in South Africa. Again, you mentioned the Humber Engineering where, I mean, the capacity has grown substantially far beyond the targets that were set up. And also in terms of sleepers, two companies in South Africa invested, one which is 51% transformed, which is rail to rail. We've got the GPT group, 40% transformed, creating 80 jobs, 35 jobs, 91 million rand investment in plant, 73 million rand investment in plant. Also creating jobs in more rural areas. The one plant is in Ladysmith and the other plant is in Kimberley, where we are producing high quality sleepers at Kimberley. Some of the other transactions that we've done on fuel and internal audit, external audit, is not localization. It's basically creating the development of South African companies. On the fuel, you know, we achieved 9 black-owned businesses, of which 8 are 100% black-owned, and 5 of those companies are 100% black women-owned, actually awarded, was awarded the contract for the supply of fuel for transport. On the internal and external audit market, we actually caused a change in the sector. With our tenders, we assisted the black-owned audit firm to actually merge with the creation of Suzanne Freeberg Aborda for our external audit, as well as for Shekela Nabiso to merge for our internal audit. This internal audit is the largest internal audit function in the world, and we are very proud that we can have had such a massive influence in that sector. We are creating competition for the old state audit companies that exist. We're also now looking to go into this line. We are looking at our EPCM, which is engineering, procurement and construction management in construction business that we acquire infrastructure, where we must get transformation. We're also looking at the construction industry as well as the ancillary services to try and make the same influence that we can then make sure that we develop the right organization in empowerment, transformation, and sustainable economic growth. There's also a lot of new companies that have come through the Transnet Engineering Supply Development Program. You know, we've spent 268 million rand on them, developing them. We've also got success stories with the Hollister company in India, Mark, USDs, as well as DMEs in terms of how we're achieving them. Then the last slide talks to the localization units through the DCI and DST. We are looking at developing and incubating black-owned organizations into the engineering space. Now, I think there's about a list of 14, 15 companies also identifying their black ownerships who are actually coming through the incubation program at Transnet Engineering and who are now becoming players within that market where they can meaningfully participate and deliver in those industries.
Maybe if I could just add, we have one last section which I'll touch on in interest of time, which is enterprise development. We know that most developed countries have about 50% of the region.
We may give you 5 minutes. I do need to get an introduction from Prasa because we will be inviting you back next week.
Thank you, Jay. In terms of GDP contribution, SMEs in developed countries contribute about 50% of GDP. In South Africa, the reality is they contribute 30%. Which is a problem. And therefore, we at Transnet are not just looking at these macroeconomic big industrialization programs, we're looking at the grassroots bottom up, as I just stated, where we try and help develop these SMEs with particular emphasis on black-owned, black-women-owned businesses, black-youth-owned businesses. And through building these businesses, we'll create jobs. So what we're looking to do, if you look at slides 43, 44, and 45, these are some of the enterprise development initiatives, such as opening enterprise development hubs. We've opened 3 in the country. We're opening another 2 soon. We've got various funding structures, such as the FIDISA Fund, incubation. We have various other productivity and production efficiency campaigns and initiatives, all targeted at smaller businesses. We're going to be opening a research and innovation center to help target innovative ideas which are commercially viable, and various other initiatives focusing on disabled people, where we're looking at a furniture manufacturing business, as well as establishing a driving school and computer learning for disabled people. So these are just some of the initiatives. Slide 47 shows where our enterprise development has been opened. You can see we've opened in Saldana, we've opened in the R. The call center was a pilot and will be opening in Tumashi and in Pazani very, very shortly. The last slide I want to highlight in summary is just basically our commitment to enterprise and supplier development. Transit remains committed to driving transformation and empowerment through a supplier base, as well as leveraging the procurement scheme to create as much localization and industrialization as possible. So we need to walk the talk, and each has shown that we are making significant inroads as it relates to supplier development, enterprise development, and spend on better businesses. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. As I indicated to you, we will be asking you to return here on, I think it is the 19th, Wednesday. So this will be in the nature of an introduction to the area, but we'll also send email to you a number of questions linked to this, so that when you return, you will you will be able to respond to that, plus engage. Prasa, please. So that was very much a thank you to Mr. Peter and Mr. Gian. No, hang on. Where are we? That was Consulate. Mr. Gianni, is that right? Because I think we didn't see Mr. Gianni. Mr. Peter?
Yes, Mr. Peter and Mr. Thompson representing Mr. Jones.
Right, thank you. Right, yourself, Mr. Sabola, I think you are aware that you will provide an introduction before you return on Wednesday. Is that right? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be quick just to introduce and having understood the brief what sort of impact that the industrial policy action plan did with regard to the early contributing and program of obvious of PRASA. We will share with the Commission how we have approached it and what sort of an engagement we have obviously in the market and the strategy of our procurement as we acquire this 3,600 octane, and what are sort of some of the selling figures that are obviously coming through this particular program as expected where, and what are sort of the plans with regard to the factory and side of this. Madam Chair, I must emphasize that we are driven by our investment outlook. There is absolutely no way that we can achieve the high levels of localization without investing on a long term, but also with a fair amount of certainty. So we are driven from our side about 172 billion, that's what we are estimating, which we have kicked off in 2014-15 financial year, where we will invest about 172 billion, of which 51 billion investment in projects will be part of this program. But the combination of quite a number of investment that support us results in our program. Madam Chair, besides there are two elements which I think are very relevant to this particular committee, which is going to be obviously the market engagement and the economic evaluation. As much as we did the due diligence and the legal analysis of this particular program, and of course how we then approach the procurement, what was our procurement strategy, and understood what are the government policies that we needed to follow. In this slide, Madam Chair, the point is that we have made sure we have involved the policy department, especially in regard to the Ministry of Trade and Industry, which formed an integral part for us to actually achieve the levels of localization that we do have achieved with the committee. It is important to note that our investment outlook, Madam Chair, is about 20 years, investing consistently without failing, which then starts this year, 2015, about 2035, once we completely started the process, we have invested about 124 billion rand, just pure on the acquisition of your rolling stock. We will have been obviously at around 7,224 new vehicles over that sort of period. It's an important aspect to pull across, because in the market itself, that's what the market always wants to see. You go to the market and indicate we need this level of localization, but if you're investing 2 to 3 years, those levels you never really achieve them. So this was important for us to make sure that our long-term outlook gets put out there into the market so that it's well understood. With this sort of investment, we have no doubt we will achieve not less than 55% local content, which will then obviously translate to creating jobs that are between 65,000, both direct and of course indirect, for the period 2015 and 2035. And that's important to obviously note at this point in time. When we did the business study in 2011, Madam Chair, we worked on three scenarios on 50% localization, 55%, and of course the 30% localization. And what came out of those results is that if we do put about 103 billion rand investment from an expenditure perspective, we are likely to achieve 255 billion using a 2.5 multiplier effect in the transport sector, which I think we can start to see that about 56 billion rand. We'd like to come back to the future through personal taxes, company taxes, as it were. So it's a great investment by any stroke of imagination. And these are some of the jobs that we are able to create a success area, about 55,000 approximately over the next 20 years. Madam Chair, it was very important for us to engage with the market, not just to assume it. As much as we understood what the industrial qualification plan wanted, we needed to understand whether the market would have an appetite and what level. So we undertook market engagement in 2011, where we established quite a number of things, the localization, which was 65%, we as a minimum, and what sort of preferential procurement that we wanted to put in place, and from a financial perspective, whether we have had that appetite to fund a program like this one on a long-term basis. It was very clear that, and this was market consensus around localization. The market indicated that they need at least contracts that are not less than 5 years, plus minus 5 to 10 years, achieving about 250 vehicles at least a year to justify the level of 55% local content that we were actually starting to put out. And that's very, very important. That is a typical 8-hour shift, 5 days a week, kind of an operation. And that's where Rolling Stock manufacturer indicated that that's the way they are able to reach what you call efficiency levels. So that's basically what came out of that sort of market engagement at the time. But also we did what we call an online market engagement, where we wanted to find out whether the supply industry is out there, what capacity and capability do exist, and whether it can have a potential take-up on particular. And it was very clear that in terms of the component supply, maintenance, there was a very strong appetite for that sort of, for the local industry participation in the program itself. Government policies, it has always been a guiding point, I don't have to repeat that, but I have the new growth path, and of course the whole preferential document, what is what involved does, obviously, as we embarked on this one. It was clear by the end of it that not only we needed to buy the modern trains, but we also needed to re-engineize and regenerate the rail industry, which obviously came to a standstill at least until the mid-80s. So we needed to use this particular problem, and the rent that we are spending on this to re-engineize the rail industry. And that's what we took, and because that's the sort of the capacity we actually collapsed at least until around 1986 or so. But it's important that we create a supply chain that is likely to be good and competitive. It's not sufficient to say price and Transnet, we're not going to buy them forever. You know, at some point, that market will also change its own currency. And the issue for us, obviously, the one that says, are we creating an industry that can obviously enter other markets in the rest of Africa and internationally as well. and that's the land that we obviously have in mind. We need to strategize that in that sort of perspective, and that's the thing we have. Let me share my sense of mind that there is a lot of strong emphasis, especially when you look at the cultures who are in terms of the industry that we are looking at, which is not necessarily transformed, but we wanted to make sure how we measure that we increase flexibility within the rail space, and how do we make sure that we increase as many jobs as possible, especially for black groups, women and youth participation within the process, and of course the economic development as well.
I want to remind you, you've got 7 minutes left.
Having understood all of those, on the 14th of October 2018, we signed a 10-year deal with Delaware Transport Company, to supply about 3,600 vehicles for the 10 years between 2015 and 2025, sorry, and another contract which ran between 2015 and 2023 for the technical support and the supply agreement. That contract is worth about 61 million. And this is the company, just to introduce it, is led by Alstom, which owns about 51%, but you can see it's also got about 89% shareholding from South African participants. From a equity perspective, we understood that preferential. That's all we did. We made sure that at least we don't achieve not less than 50% shareholding by South African companies within that. Of course, by virtue of Alstom shareholding, this becomes what we call a subsidiary of Alstom, but this is a sort of a pretty well company that is just created. So let's see, just you can see that out of the 51 billion, about 36 billion rand will have to be spent on South African companies. So those rental sites will remain in the country, they will not leave the country. On top of that, 500 billion rand will be spent on SMEs. Again, those small medium enterprises will remain in the country. On top of that, about 1.7 billion rand will be spent towards women-owned companies. Again, those random trends, they will all be accounted for in the country at the South African space from a spend perspective. On top of that, we said about 802 on the enterprise development, and of course, in addition, we spent about 323 million rand on socio-economic development. All we do here on the socio-economic side, we look at the areas those are specifically affected, which I'll talk to in a second, that if they need for schools, they need for clinics, roads, and all of those. That's the thought process around it. Madam Chair, I must emphasize that we have identified a lady in Kurleni, Niger, in the west of Johannesburg. It's about 288 hectares of land where the factory would be built up, and our plan is that the factory ought to be operational by July 2016. That factory will produce about 580 trains, which is a short of 20 trains, which was later called that the trains will come from Brazil for two obvious reasons. One is that we didn't want to wait for that long to receive our first train, but secondly, that we wanted to allow a certain amount of time for the training program of our own engineers, which have already been shipped out to Brazil and Paris. They are being currently trained on designing across the side of things. Local content. On both the manufacturing phase and the maintenance phase, you can see not only did we achieve 60%, we are averaging over 70% of local content. So we have over surpassed what we thought was the minimum. And these are the numbers, and I think we'll talk about them in detail when we return. Product evolution facility, we created another facility where we call it the design, a sort of one-stop shop, where some of the engineers will have the know-how how to produce a train going forward. I must emphasize on the skills right, 9,500 will be trained over the next 10 years, and you can see these are hardcore skills. In terms of 6,766 is earmarked participants, engineers about 4,600, and you can see the numbers are quite large. We're making good progress. That's the train from Brazil, is the picture. It's coming through in November this year, so we are still on track. Currently, we have about 28 companies that we've been contracted for on local components. I must emphasize that even though the 23 from Brazil will not be matching for local content, the truth of the matter is that we have a company on the same scale and that on a large that are shipping out material from South Africa to Brazil, and those people, when they come back, they will come with some of the material as well. Job creation, if we let us in a minute, I'm done here. About 115 jobs have been created through Jela, just only Jela, and about 90% of those jobs have been created for some of the citizens and we can see some of those details. So it's been quite a good progress. Money engagements are continuing as well, as I've spoken about earlier. But the last point I wanted to make on this one is that we have signed an agreement with Rostana to do monitoring of the localization assets as we move forward. We talk about the hedging side in detail in the time. Chair, that's basically what we have from our side.
I want to thank you very much for agreeing to come back. Really taking a piece of the world, and then you'll sort of enable us to forward to issues to you, and we really appreciate Carson and Sanchez in coming back to us and agreeing, and if Tarsha can return, that would also be helpful. So you will get your full time at that point. For all of you who've been here, it's been a very constructive input. But I know members of the committee do believe that they have not engaged sufficiently with you. So we will have to try and fit you in at some other time later on in the year. But thank you all of you for being here. That takes us, just as a reminder, that on the 19th Wednesday, we've changed the program with us to ensure that we can include the presentations, which are vitally important to our objectives as a country. Thank you for the presenters who have been here, to all of you. Thank you to members for being here as well, and we are going to adjourn the meeting until tomorrow. And tomorrow, that is Wednesday, the 12th, there will be public hearings and processing beginning at 9 o'clock.